understand who is here before we start the meeting. I know we are expecting the Department of Justice, but we are also expecting the Western Cape Network. Are they here already? Not yet. Okay. Can I welcome everybody to the meeting? Perhaps we could just have a brief introduction from the department. Tell us who you are. And then we'll kick off from there.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Simon Gianni. I'm the Deputy Director General responsible for Court Services in the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development. And within the branch court services, we have a number of chief directorates responsible for specific areas. And I think the more important one today is the chief director responsible for the promotion, protection and the promotion of the vulnerable groups, right? And that chief directorate is headed by Advocate Shireen Said on my right-hand side, who's then assisted by the director in that responsible for child justice issues, Collier Cook. So those are the representations from the Department of Justice. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. So just the three of you from the department. Could we understand who the other visitors are?
I'm Dee Smart. I'm the Director of the Law, Race and Gender Unit in the Department of Public Law at the University of Cape Town. And these are my four honours students, who I'm sure can introduce themselves, in a course called Criminal Process.
That's all. We want to know everybody who's there.
I'm Lewis Law. I'm from the Catholic Parliamentary Liaison Office.
My name is Patricia Whittle. I'm a researcher with the Select Committee on Security and Prostitution of Death.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm a researcher, also
researcher for the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development. Thank you. The Department of Justice, you are free to begin.
Thank you very much for the invitation to be here today. But I think just before we started our invitation, I just needed just to give a little bit of background in terms of the presentation that we'll be doing here, and also how it fits in very well within the broader scheme of government. Chair, I just need to indicate as well that we have a number of clusters within the within government, and as justice to serve on two clusters. One is the justice crime prevention, and which is called the JCPS. And then the second one is on the social cluster. Now, on the JCPS cluster, the department leads in a number of areas, we coordinate the work of the rest of the other departments that form part of the cluster, and this, amongst others, includes the work that is done by social development, work done by the correctional services, the South African and the police services, home affairs, including justice. And so in those matters, we do lead, we have a number of subcommittees that have been established in the cluster where we lead on many issues relating to the protection of the vulnerable groups, including women as well as children. On the social cluster, which is but our sister cluster, but in there we just have some parallel programs that we run, which we coordinate on behalf of the rest of the cluster. And so the presentation that I'm going to be doing in relation to the issues that I think the committee wants some briefing on, they relate more also in terms of how we as a cluster, you know, approach these things. It's just unfortunate that I think in terms of this invitation, not the entire cluster was invited, but I think it last maybe at some point in time that similar presentations that are made so that you come in here as the whole representation of the cluster, so that you get the whole spectrum in terms of how the value chain works in terms of our work.
Just to disturb you a bit, just to make you aware that last week we had a presentation from the police services. So I thought, let me just tell you that, that we've already had a presentation from the police. So I didn't want you shifting something over to the police and the police shifting something over to you. Just making you aware that we've had a presentation from the police services.
No, I think I'm just raising this because it has been the practice that whenever we are in Parliament, we come in as a cluster on presenting on issues that relate to, you know, for example, on women issues and so on. So we don't look at departments separately. So I'm just raising that as a side issue that perhaps at some point in time the committee can some reflection on it. We will do our bit in terms of indicating exactly the issues that we're dealing with as a Department of Justice. But I think the issue that I was just trying to put the message across that our initiative cut across the cluster as a whole, and I'm just raising that I think as an issue. So I think in terms of your invitation, there are specific issues that we'll deal with. I think some of the issues that have been raised in the invitation, I think, don't fall within the ambit of our responsibility, but we will just maybe take the committee through those issues that are relevant to the Department of Justice and those that we're leading in terms of the cluster. So I will request Advocate Said, you know, Sharon Said, just to lead us in terms of that.
Could I cut you off with this? Could you try and assist this team? This is someone else. I see a chair there. Is that chair? There's a lot of chair there. There's a chair that is there.
Set up, so we'll have to confine ourselves to the copies. And I want to start our presentation against the following backdrop with regard to the promotion of the rights of vulnerable groups. An approach that we have adopted now is looking at it, especially with the constitutional framework being a rights one, moving most of our work to from basing it and premising it on a rights-based framework. So a lot of the strategic objectives you will see are at this stage at a very high level, but of course are unpacked in a little bit more detail as one goes through some of the presentations. The other point and principle against which I'd like to premise the presentation, as you would have heard Mr. Gianni say, that we are the lead cluster on several aspects, not that we necessarily drive some processes. And the reason I say that is that justice services generally are the service that you get as a last resort. Now, sometimes you'll find on many issues that come through, they come through as the first resort, or people looking for legal services or justice services as the first and sometimes the only resort. So having that as a background, we find that when people get to our court system, a lot of our intervention has to also be social in nature, which isn't quite the right place for it to be. And that's part of why the clustering has made a huge difference to how we approach a lot of the issues that face us. And if you look then at the strategic objective, promotion and protection of the rights of children, as an example, the lead department in that respect would be the Department of Social Development. And our intervention with the rights of children would be only insofar as they then enter into the court system. But entering into the court system has the premise that you would have to first go through social development services, SAP services, and then if your property matter then comes to the court, would we then intervene? So in that regard, you would see on slide 2, we look at the chapter 4 of the Children's Act once you are in the court process. And what we're looking at from the department also is the development of the National Policy Framework on Child Justice. And I will take you through so far what we are, because we're the lead department on that, where we are with the Child Justice Act and the implementation thereof, and also go through some of the other detail around child justice in general, which forms the substantive part of today's presentation. The other objective that we have as the department is increasing the number of children just diverted from the formal justice system, and formal must be seen in inverted commas. Some of the other strategic objectives that are related to women and children in particular is that of restorative justice and how we can resolve disputes without having it to be litigious. And again, the point is sometimes the services may not necessarily need the full trust of the law, as it were. Strategic Objective 17, all of this is based on the department's MTSF, is to manage sexual offences, domestic violence and maintenance. And then Strategic Objective 18 looks at the family law services to protect the interests of children. That particular objective is rather specific to the role of the family advocate and the kind of services that they deliver. If you look under Strategic Objective 17, if I may take you back a little bit, looks at, and as the lead department, we manage the implementation of the Sexual Offences Act, which is the other areas of question that has come up for this morning, and then on domestic violence. Mr. Gianni already raised our lead in the cluster by taking you through to slide 4, which deals with the, as I've said already now, Child Justice Act through the Intersectional Committee on Child Justice, and the Criminal Law Amendment, which is the Sexual Offences Act, and then the restorative justice processes across the cluster, both criminal and civil. So those are the areas of work that we need. And we stress the point of needing because we coordinate most of the efforts, because obviously, as we've noted, and remember, we're also building on a lot of the frameworks that were there. As departments, we still operate independently of each other in terms of accountability, but of course services, which is why I say a rights approach is such that when I get to a court, I don't ask, I need now justice services or I need social development. I get there as a full human being and I need whatever service to enable my process. And the thrust, if you look also at the more recent pieces of legislation of the Department of Justice, is to deliver a justice service that is more therapeutic and restorative in nature. You will see that very clearly in the spirit and preamble of the Child Justice Act. You will see that running through the Sexual Offences Amendment Act and also some of the other bills that are coming through because of the recognition of how victims of crime and how service delivery has been, in that it's been quite fragmented across the cluster. So having this clustered approach enables us, especially at the steering committee level, to problem solve without having to always go back to each department and wait for the internal processes to happen, and at the level of the thematic areas, the levels of officials are quite senior, and usually they're chaired by a chief director, and if we can't solve a problem in that regard, it then goes up to the development committee, which is chaired by DDG and usually is comprised of members of other DDGs and sometimes chief directors, which enables then more quicker policy and problem-solving interventions should there be such issues. If I then go on to slide 5, which really looks at the whole Child Justice Act and its implementation for now, and I think one has to also, to some respect, commend the committee on Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development, and I don't say that as a bias being from the department, but it's one of the first few pieces of legislation that has come up in the history of our new dispensation where on its date of implementation, it will have an operational system to support it. If you look historically at pieces of legislation, you'll have them introduced into Parliament, and the systems follow thereafter. I think the Domestic Violence Act is a perfect example that almost 10 years later, you're still putting up systems. And this was one of those cases where the committee was very adamant that it must be, all processes and systems must be tabled, if you look at this slide, in Parliament by December 2009, which is at the end of this year, but more importantly, Parliament put a proviso, because December is really not a month when Parliament meets throughout, that in the event that the committee does not approve or have the opportunity to consider what has been tabled, that it will be deemed, if you look at that enabling provision in the Child Justice Act, it will be deemed to have been approved. So again, it was an accountability mechanism. And what that really means is that all systems like the diversion framework, which is in the Act, the policies and the systems in terms of service delivery must have been in place by December 2009. And what is again is unique is the Act comes into effect and full operation on the 1st April 2010. So we'd like to think that that's not an April Fool joke, but it's also the day, and we coincided that with respect to the the commencement of a new financial year. Because the other challenge that you have when a bill comes into effect is that a budget cycle works 2 or 3 years ahead. And if you don't have, and in fact, the Child Justice Bill, to give you some history, took almost 10 years, was almost 10 years in the making. And at the time, Treasury had given it somewhat of a budget. But because it was a bill, it never really took off. And so the position now is until you have an act on the table, you would get a budget. So what we've done now is we've secured budgets for the following year cycles, but for now we're using the departmental budgets to enable us to commence some of the provisions. The other interesting thing about this particular one, now it's an act, is because it started 10 years, it was one of the first few new pieces of legislation when the new government took over in 1994, was that a lot of processes in preparation for its operation, it was thought that it would have come into effect within, from 1994, within 2 or 3 years thereafter, and it didn't. So a lot of processes in government had already commenced. In fact, the Department of Justice at the time had already commenced to put up and secure services so that we could start testing how workable the bill was and what systems needed to be put in place, taking one back to 1994 and how much further our systems across the cluster was fragmented. So if you look on slide 5, it was signed on the 7th of May. It will come into operation on the 1st of April 2010. Regulations must be in by December 2009. Now, the other point which is required is for a national policy framework to be in place by December 2009. However, and the operative word there is May, because of the commencement of the Act on the 1st of April 2010. The committee, which is chaired by a Director General, the operational committee, which has been in existence for almost 10 years, and I'll speak to that a little bit later, will only take effect after the bill comes into operation. So technically and legally speaking, the policy framework is a draft one adopted by that DG's intersectoral committee, which is then presented and approved by the ministers responsible for the administration of justice. And a year after the Act comes into effect, in terms of the Act, must the policy framework be tabled in Parliament. So our hope is that we can already, because it makes it, and this was one of the very strong monitoring processes in the debate of the bill, to ensure that there's accountability at every stage, and also that there's a guiding ethos and principle. We are trying our best to have the policy framework, if possible, tabled a little bit sooner, though legally and technically it need not be, but a policy framework really guides in the absence of any other process that may not be there to assist us in the implementation of the Act. And then I've just put in some other dates to help us through understanding the time frames. The annual report, as I say, must also, which is really the policy framework together with the progress on the implementation of the Act, which must be submitted or tabled in Parliament in 2011. And thereafter, again, I'll talk to the monitoring and evaluation component of this Act. There's a five-year review process to look at what progress has been made. And this is taking into account the fact that after 5 years of a policy being in place, how applicable is it? How relevant is it? Because dynamics and societal needs may have changed over a period of time. One specific issue of the five-year review, as you would know, is the age of capacity for children. The age of criminal capacity, because you would know in terms of our current law, you have the rebuttable and irrebuttable presumption of innocence of children, firstly under 7 category and then 7 to 14. And one of the choices we didn't want to make as a country in terms of policy, which the Portfolio Committee decided on, was let's wait a 5-year period and assess how many children are coming through our courts, and is our intervention really a court-based approach, or is it really social intervention that we require? So that's part of the purpose of the five-year review. Now, that's just taking us into account in terms of what that Act requires. The other unique features which you'll find on slide 6 is some of the principles of the Child Justice Act. It's been a bill for 10, 11 years, so one grapples with the terminology that I still to this day, I'm in disbelief that it's actually an act after so many years. So pardon me when I keep fluctuating with that term. You will see in the preamble, particularly of this act, it's holistic in that the rights, you know, with the constitutional framework and the rights-based approach, all rights are indivisible, interrelated, and interdependent. With our constitution and Section 28, which promotes that the best interests of the child shall be paramount in every situation, that principle is further entrenched and amplified. In fact, it's gone even beyond the amplification. It's operationalized in this particular act because it has a child-centered approach in all respects, so that one looks at what are the needs of the child, what is in its best interest for every stage in the bill. And you will see as we go through some aspects of the act how that pans itself out. And then the whole point of the child-centered point is I've already made. Sorry, the accountability was meant to be a separate point, but it just got conglomerated there with the child-centered approach. Accountability, again, is another unique feature of the bill. And Madam Chair, you were raising the point earlier about one need not shift responsibility between departments. that has been recognized, especially with the fragmented criminal justice system that we've had, recognized that because of the interdependence of departments in terms of the trust of services, this bill, this act recognized that if I pass through the business process from police hands, then the first point of entry would be being arrested and charged for child justice as a child in conflict with the law. And sometimes, because if you look at our numbers of children that are arrested, they may not necessarily need an intervention of a justice system. There may be a child in need of care. And you'll see that number turns around almost about 50% within the first 48 hours of arrest, because the child on reception and referral, which is now social development, the part of the social development responsibility, that child is assessed, and if it's found that you may be a child in need of care, you immediately refer to the appropriate service. Now, the point of accountability in the Act is such that a police, and it's invoked, has got to have, there's a regulation that says, I've now handed this over to the Department of Social Development, whereas currently it's a verbal handover. You would pick up the phone in practice and say, I have a child here. This child, for argument's sake, looks about 9 to 10 years old, but I'm not sure, can you dispatch a social worker if one is not physically in the police station? Because most of our reception and referral rooms and centers are based at the bigger police stations. But in a more outlined, smaller area, you might have a social worker that is servicing the entire cluster. The police officer would phone, and then sometimes if that police officer is not on duty, nobody knows if the social worker would have been phoned. And it becomes very hard for us to, because if I come before a committee like this and one of the MPs would have found out in my constituency this is what's happening, it's very hard for me to intervene if you don't have police officer number name. Then I've got a generic complaint, which is very difficult to engage with. So what the bill now, the Act now does, it says, police officer so-and-so has handed the child and a piece of paper follows through. Similarly with social development, and you see that throughout the business process, so that we can pinpoint, and that must be also, which is also part of the monitoring and evaluation component of this Act, which then says, can you make sure you have this on an information system, so we can see as an example, which we found, and I think previously the Portfolio Committee on Correctional Services found when they would do oversight visits, many children sitting in pockets in the country. So this is to enable us to say, if a particular practice is still going on, maybe in a area where you can determine there's a particular trend, and certain children are not process as quickly as possible, having this in our database will enable us to pick up those trends and immediately resolve problems, whereas currently we're still quite manual, and so unless we have the details, becomes a bit of a challenge. Again, the child-centered approach in the monitoring and evaluation system is entrenched by the type of training. And you will see in the directives and the training component of the Child Justice Act that we need to have training for all personnel that deal with children. One of the training requirements which is entrenched in the Act is that you need to first look at child development. So irrespective of whether you're a child in trouble with the law, which is a different facet, you need to have training on child development. Understand what a child needs, understand the trauma that a child can face, and what are the dysfunctions. Understand also that if a child's coming through a system in conflict with the law, there has got to be some dysfunctionality either in the community or in the family, or sharpshoot as to where this dysfunctionality is. But the idea of the training, which is what each department has to report to Parliament on, is understand that so you can identify it and respond, as opposed to a child in trouble with the law, here's the might of the law, arrest, and here's how you proceed. And then, of course, I've already spoken to the issues of review. I've also spoken on the last point on the operational system on the date of implementation. I hope by now our system would have worked, but technology doesn't wait when it works, so we're still confined to the slides. If I move now onto slide 7, which talks about the oversight committee, and now I've given you a little bit of a background, not on the principles, the actual issues on the Act, but just some of the guiding principles. If you look at the Intersectoral Committee on Child Justice, this committee, as I said, is almost 10 to 11 years old. And why it's at this age, in fact, being a child committee, it's the oldest of most clustered committees in government, which is quite ironic. When the bill commenced discussion almost 10, 11 years ago, one of the points, a committee was set up so that we would have an integrated bill, because it was quite common when departments came up with bills, it was focusing on what its services would be and everything else was peripheral. But this one was quite specific that let's involve all of the departments in the thinking and the development of the bill, and this committee got set up. In fact, it was the Interministerial Committee on Children and Youth at Risk, I think when Ms. Mulcahy was the Minister of Social Development at the time. She set up this committee to just look at how many children were in detention. This was in 1994. What this committee then did is ensures that on a monthly basis, all the departments meet to look at the issues of child justice. And what is now being entrenched in the Act is that this committee, is what I spoke about, is now upgraded or elevated in terms of a Director General because of the commitment of government to trying and reducing the population of children going through who are in conflict with the law, so that higher and more imminent policy interventions can be made. The current committee, which is the operational one and will feed through the current cluster, not only has government departments, and again it's unique in that we have members of the civil society organizations currently sitting on it, and the members of civil society organizations include the National House of Traditional Leaders. We also have some of the Chapter 9 institutions, and predominantly I think our very regular member there is the Public Protector's Office. On occasion we have the South African Human Rights Commission also attending, and in fact the Public Protector's Office has helped us fast track those cases in areas where we find matters taking quite a long time to be processed and enable us to intervene as quickly as possible. We also have the magistracy sitting through the lower court magistrate committee, and also the judicial inspectorate of prisons. Even though it says prisons, they still go into detention facilities, police detention facilities, to see if children are in detention and why they may still be there and what interventions could be made. Now, over and above this, because this is a national structure, we have in the last year, 2 years, set up regional fora headed by the Department of Justice in each of the 9 regions to have the provincial child justice fora, because most obviously with the way our services are organized, it's quicker for the regions to intervene because they might meet more sooner and have direct intervention with the children coming in, as opposed to the national committee. And the national committee only issues that cannot be managed at the lower committee, which might need more intervention from a policy angle, or might have to cut through a little bit more red tape sometimes, if I may use that colloquially to explain it. Issues are elevated to the national committee. So these nine committees at the provincial level have been in operation for the last two and a half years, and I must say we have in fact improved our ability to intervene far quicker with these regional committees being in place. Thus far on the implementation of this Act, here's what has already taken place. And again, I think it's quite phenomenal, even if we may say so ourselves as a department, in that we've commenced a lot of the preparation for training in anticipation of the tabling in December. And that is the training components have already occurred for magistrates. And what we've now also developed is one generic training manual, so that all cluster all personnel in the cluster, including judicial officers, would have one generic manual on child justice. And that's the basis, and this was developed already with a curricula. We're just waiting for the finalization of that, but it's almost complete with all of the different departments, including the magistracy, and we've had some non-governmental persons on it advising us on what needs to be included in the training. Once we finalize that, we'll commence with training, further training. But what has already taken place is we've had rounds of what it also means, because this is a generic training manual, each department will still, having this as the backdrop, this training manual as the backdrop, then tailor make its training package to police services, if it's social development, and so on and so on. Police have already commenced quite a great deal of training. I'm sure they have raised this with you in their session. Social development, because they already render the service in any case, has comment their training. We've also had a range of magistrates. In fact, this is thanks also to many of the non-governmental organizations who have already done rounds of training on the Child Justice Act. They've done rounds of training on non-custodial options, getting presiding officers to think of a different way of sentencing children who don't have to serve a sentence in prison but still have to serve a sentence to remedy whatever behavior might have been offenses and got them into trouble with the law in the first place. The Child and Youth Care Centers, as you could see, in the Children's Act, in fact, the two acts were not compatible at the time, the Child Justice Act and the Children's Act, because the Child Justice Act spoke about one-stop centers, and the Children's Act spoke about child and youth care centers. And if you would recall, and I'm sure Social Development spoke about this when they were before you, they have currently the secure care facilities. And a way in which we found to manage this more effectively and perhaps be more productive, because it's one of the objects of both the Children's Act and the Child Justice Act, is to consolidate as much and be more productive. That is the constitutional provision, to be more productive in the use of our resources. So we've coupled with some of the secure care centers to ensure, because if you look at the Child Justice Act, we may proclaim a seat of court in a one-stop center. Does not preclude us from proclaiming that seat of court in a secure care facility. So it actually makes the service delivery more productive, in that children can immediately at the secure care center, if that center has been proclaimed a seat of court, run the processes of bail and plea all at once, instead of now taking a child from a secure care center to the main magisterial district and transporting them back. Because these one-stop centers and secure care centers could also have facilities where children would be detained in a police service center. So we've coupled those two. For now, we only have two centers. At the time it was tested, the Mangaung Center in the Free State and the Narina Center in Port Elizabeth. In fact, the Mangaung Center has won the UN recognition of service excellence because of the concept of the center. And what we also found is that we have become a model for many countries in Africa in terms of consolidating the children's services when they trouble with the law. So far, we've had the Malawians, the Zambians coming and looking at how these centers actually work. What we're in the process of rolling out further in the next year, if we can, is an additional center in Northwest and one in KwaZulu-Natal. KwaZulu-Natal, as you would know, together with the Eastern Cape and Gauteng, our numbers of children being processed are about the highest. Excuse me. The diversion policy framework, we've already commenced with that. You would know diversion as a process on its own has thus far been very informal. It is never recognized in our law. So a lot of the processes and information has been done fully formally with prosecutors and a service like NICRO. They've been the biggest service provider in the country on diversion services. So if you pleaded guilty and the prosecutor felt, well, you know, yes, if you plead guilty, you've taken accountability, you can go on a program and then you don't get a court record. And that's been very informally done. The bill now, for the first time, legislates for it. So it will also mean that we'll now know how many children actually get diverted. And since we've been collecting statistics, we've seen a huge increase of diversion and a decrease of children then going further into the system, the full criminal justice system. Now that diversion policy in terms of the Act has got to be done in consultation with the other departments. As prescribed by law, and then it has to be, that will also be tabled. We've commenced the process of looking at what programs must be included. So the idea is to quality control programs. So if we found it out, because at the moment what you have, and this is a phenomenon of restorative justice across the country, is programs taking place without them being vetted or credited by departments. So you could get a diversion program that may not be suitable. And then you wouldn't be able to detect it at the moment. But this act and this accreditation process now formalizes it, where each year you must come back and get a certificate from the Department of Social Development, who will check that you are able to manage your finances, you are delivering a service that is actually helping children, not for the sake of you going through a program.
Just on that, how do you monitor this?
This is what the bill now is, the Act 9 envisages it. At the moment, social development has an accreditation framework. They're the department that manages diversion. And so each time you present a proposal to the Department of Social Development, you've got to have satisfied all their current criteria. What the bill now says is that criteria must be pre-approved. Which currently it's done through the department. It's not done in terms of a process tabled in Parliament. Pre-approved so that we can check quality. And Parliament itself must check the quality. It's in fact one of the review mechanisms in the monitoring and evaluation, because we've had reports of diversion services which aren't really yielding the result. It's there for the sake of it. Or it could also be that some NGO wants to have funds and provide a service, but it's not really having a child who's not being rehabilitated. And the idea is that we are restorative so that children don't reoffend. In fact, statistics across the world show that when children, especially even for sex offenders, when children have gone through a program of management of the sex offence or one on child where you're in conflict with the law, the rate of recidivism is actually lower. Whereas for adults, it's a whole lot harder to almost retrain, if I use the word rather loosely. There's a specific term that psychologists and social workers use, and I'm not familiar with the term, so I hope they'll forgive me on just using the word reprogramming you, as it were, so you don't reoffend. The national policy framework we've spoken about at length. The other challenge that we've had in government is our indicators are not always in a rights-based framework. So the indicators for Department of Justice, as an example, may be a priority, but for social development may not be a priority, or for SAC, it's not a priority. What we've done for this Act is develop our indicators, and we've used the UN standard of indicators for child justice, but we've contextualized it being an African country. The UN indicators are rather international, not Afrocentric to a large extent, and furthermore, South Africa's environment. So we have actually amplified it further, and our indicators are developed in that regard. An integrated case management system is what we've already completed for the Department of Justice, but now we are interfacing with the other government departments so that as a child walks into the system, child A doesn't become child DSD number and then justice number, which is currently what happens in the system because our systems are not interfacing. And this act now enables us, which is what we're in the process of doing through the integrated justice system and interface process. And then lastly, I just wanted to point out on the regulations. We've already commenced the draft of the regulations. We've been through several drafts. Obviously, once it's internally approved and teased out, we will be ready to present that in December 2009. Just some overview and impact of the work already done on child justice. If you look at just the numbers of children in detention, which is slide 9, you will just see that we have decreased since 2005 the number of children sentenced in DCS facilities by 50%. I'm hoping the slides will come up with that statistic, but that's one of the, I would like to think, a key success of the intersexual collaboration of the Child Justice Sexual Committee. But what one must also note is that since 2005, when diversion and non-custodial sanctions, because still non-custodial sanctions in terms of the current Criminal Procedure Act, which we're governed by, is not a sentence on its own. It has to be a conditional or a postponed sentence, as the current law allows. Whereas with this one, it does not have to be a conditional or postponed sentence. You can be sentenced to anger management, as an example. Whereas at this point in time, you must have a conditional sentence that if you don't satisfy your anger management course, we can then put you in detention. So currently, you can sentence to imprisonment, but then they give you a condition that, well, I won't send you to prison. You must go through the following course. So it's sort of a condition on the sentence, whereas with the new act, you won't need to have that condition of going to detention if you don't satisfy it. Well, now, if you look at our non-custodial sanctions, we did a test in the last year and a half with the different departments, and as well as the Euro, which is one of the biggest service providers, and I'm hoping the NICO stats would come up, but they're not. Maybe later in the question time, you could pick that up. We've almost, with the numbers of children, 107 children were sentenced to non-custodial sanctions, and that's in a period of 1 year. Whereas previously, you would see on an average, we have about at least 1,100 children in serving sentences in DCS facilities. So having this program has already shown us in 1 year, and these were, mind you, in only 5 magisterial districts, because we were testing what the challenges we might find in the system, and we found many because of the interface. And in fact, that is the basis for developing the regulations. Again, as I said, we've decreased the number of sentenced children by 50%. The other reason, as I was saying, for why these numbers could have decreased is the following. Diversion was informal. More diversion services have been provided countrywide. So instead of children going the full gambit of the law, they would then get diverted, or they would go via one of these conditioned or suspended sentences. We've also increased the number of home-based supervision. So before, you would have children, especially 94, 95, 96, you would have children, the minute you were arrested, they would then say you go to detention, whether your parent was available, or you would have these exorbitant amounts of bail, which most parents could not afford, because usually your child was there, predominantly because of socioeconomic need, which is what we still see in terms of the sentence statistics. And so it wouldn't matter if your parents were there, if there was a guardian to take you in. Now with home-based supervision, you can serve your detention, awaiting child detention time, in terms of home-based supervision, which is run by the Department of Social Development. So you don't have to sit in detention in either police. Of course, there are conditions of bail and the nature of the crime that a presiding officer will always take into account. Another observation that we've made as to why these numbers could have decreased is that we found a higher increase of children to the children's court inquiry. So if you're a child in need of care and a magistrate or the presiding officer detects that you're actually not here, predominantly because you might have committed offence, but really after some questioning, they realize that this is a child in need of care, and this child may look 12 or 13, but it's really 10 or 11, would then decide, I can now refer this matter to the children's court inquiry. So we see that increase of usage in that regard. And also with the Legal Aid Service of South Africa, the Legal Aid Board now changed its name. We found that legal representation, in fact, it's almost 87%. As soon as a child is in detention, their service is such, and you would know that they've appointed many, many more practitioners looking predominantly at children to represent them and see how they can assist them. And our rate of return is 87%. I'm just going to pause on that one for a second. I don't know if the system's up. I'm going to take you through very quickly, which will go much quicker now, the Children's Act, and then some implementation on the Sexual Offences Amendment and the Domestic Violence. Again, I think most of the presentations on social development would have looked at the Children's Act. I'll just focus on Chapter 4, which is once you come in through the courts, and we form part of the steering committee of the Children's of social development. For ourselves in the Department of Justice, we set up our own steering committee, considering that we have 9 regional offices, and we've called it our own working group. We would like at some point, though it's not a requirement, to develop our own policy framework in terms of how children are processed through the civil children's court. To date, we've appointed 146 children's clerks. But of course, you would know from the previous presentations. Thank you. From the previous presentations, that we do not have a budget for the Children's Act as yet. But what we've done as a department is put our own budget to see as much as we can implement. So within this year, we are going to appoint an additional 120 children's court clerks. With respect to infrastructure, because you know that the Children's Act has a very strong ethos. Again, it's very child-centered and also restorative in addressing matters dealing with children. You will find the family group conference. You will find the other mechanisms of managing children's matters so that you don't go, it's more inquisitorial to a large extent. And when we say infrastructure in place, what we've done already is the Equality Court infrastructure deals with, the thrust of it is a boardroom type setup so that you can resolve disputes. And if you know the Equality Act and the way it operates, we have this infrastructure in all of our Equality Courts. Incidentally, on Friday last week, all of the other Equality Acts have been designated as it should be in terms of that act. So we're using the same infrastructure for children, because we've got that infrastructure in the court. So instead of us putting new infrastructure for children, which requires same system, we will use the Equality Court infrastructure. So that's what we mean. That does not mean that we have it across the country. It's just those areas now that we don't have, we would still have to put up more infrastructure. Then if I go through on the sexual offences. Sorry, also what I wanted to point out is there's also a lot of training material, but we're not the lead department on the training. It's done through social development where we assist on. We've also had many magistrates being trained because they would fall, even though they fall separately, they're independent of us. We've run several programs on children's issues and the new Children's Act. If I then move on to the, and I won't take more than 10 minutes now, Chair, Intersectoral Committee on Sexual Offences, this is what we have to manage the implementation of the Sexual Offences Act. And one of the challenges of this Act is that it came into effect almost immediately, and so we literally have to scramble to get the infrastructure in place. Because it's unlike the Children's Act, which I say makes it a little easier for us to implement and get the budget beforehand, which enables the implementation, all of this came into effect. And even though there was an incremental approach, the incremental approach was 3 months of each other. Even though they were on historic dates in our country's calendar, it still was in a short period of time. So we're still grappling with getting a lot of infrastructure and systems in place at this point in time. What we have is the Intersectoral Committee on Sexual Offences, which deals predominantly on the national policy framework as well as the implementation of the Act. We have all of the departments, including the National Prosecution Authority. What we also have is the national policy framework, which, and this is one of those aspects of intercluster approach, in that that Act is within a year. That policy framework must be tabled in Parliament. And we've realized with approvals and how long they take within the bureaucracy, that may not be as realistic in terms of tabling these frameworks, because you would know that we haven't tabled the framework as yet. Similarly, what we also have done is, just for in terms of implementation, is intermediaries, and I think, unfortunately, whilst we were also putting our systems in place, we had the Paswalia judgment, which occupied a lot of the media for some time. We've now had intermediaries, and if we could just get the slide on intermediaries, you'll see we've now increased the number of intermediaries. The intermediaries are not just managed by the Department of Justice, they're also managed by social development, and we're trying to coordinate, because currently we're taking the responsibility with a new policy decision to enable the services and intermediary to help children in sexual offence matters. So we've put up an additional 71 intermediaries for this year from the Department of Justice, which will bring our number of intermediaries countrywide to 230. You might ask, but you have 30-some-odd courts in the country, why don't you have 330 intermediaries? In some parts of the country, we will use a clustered system, so you have periodic courts where one magistrate prosecutor would be servicing a few courts in the same way the one intermediary would service that particular court. And then training, we've run a series of training on sexual offences already. Obviously, it's not enough. Change management is about the biggest challenge we have across the public service. So it's getting people to understand. It's wonderful to have Batopile as a concept, but understanding what that means and operationalizing it, it still poses its challenge, because you will still get people saying, I went to the court and my husband raped me, a police officer would say, or the service, whoever's providing the service, well, you know, this is a domestic issue. So as much as we've put out the training program, we still haven't changed the psyche of our country to a large extent. And with sexual offences, I think it's the responsibility of all of us. We look at the U.S. Special Rapporteur's recommendations and report. We are a country in the world which has the highest amount of violence against women, and sexual violence is quite high. Women and children, all other people as well. So that is, I think it's a phenomenon that we as a country have to look at as one of the issues of the national policy framework. What are the causes of sexual violence? Because one has to intervene there, as opposed to putting up a great legal system, as opposed to let's intervene in a more from a more causal approach. Specialization of services, that's something that we're looking at as well, not just for sexual offenses, but also for children's rights. Now, when we're looking at this, and I'm not saying that it's already done, in some aspects it is, but for us to make a major shift in policy, there's a lot of research that is still going into how we best implement it. You would have heard, and I think this committee in its previous minutes have also raised that question of some of the specialized services, one of which works very well is Zela Care Centers of the National Prosecution Authority, where you get a holistic intervention. Unfortunately, that model is not all over the country, but it was also a test process to see how we can manage that and roll that out. Together with the Department of Health, we're still aligning some of the policies. And then, of course, the National Register for Sex Offenders, where the Electronic Register for Justice is already in place, but we still have some challenges with the interfacing of the other departments. I'll now move quickly on the Domestic Violence Act, which is the last part of this presentation. And you will see that again last year, on many occasions, somebody said, it's a commemoration, and you know, if you look at domestic violence and its phenomena across our country, I don't think there's any statistic or study to this day which has really understood the full impact of domestic violence in the way it affects us in the workplace, in the way it impacts on us at home, and also on the general psyche and the impact it has on children in particular, because you will know worldwide that when a young boy watches his mother being abused, he generally, and most statistics will tell you, ends up becoming an abusive father, parent, him or herself, or, well, because of that helplessness of seeing his mother being beaten up, and generally it's women who get beaten up. Similarly, with a girl child, if she's watched her mother being beaten up, she herself will take on a partner who is abusive in that particular context. So one really has to look at the impact of domestic violence from a causal point of view, as opposed to what the system has done, what the system provides. Because of its 10 years of existence on domestic violence, which was last year, we at the department, having looked at where the systems are falling and what are the challenges, did a study which unfortunately the results have not, we haven't gotten all of, it was an empirical study that we commissioned, but we haven't quite finalized it, and I'm sure if we come back before this committee at another time, but not in the next month or two, but a little later, we will be able to present some of the findings of the study. Our preliminary findings are actually telling us as to some of the challenges that we have in the system, and a lot of it is causal. But for now, what we've looked at is how we can, where we need to strengthen is the services of processes across the different magisterial clusters, the filing and tracking systems that need to be updated, and also our referral and support for women who have been abused and need to get the kind of shelter and support and refuge at the time together with their children. Those are three of the preliminary findings that we have, but again, it's an empirical study that must come with more concrete and more finer findings, if I may say so. What we've done in the meanwhile for implementation from the justice point of view is have launched domestic violence guidelines for the judiciary because of its non-standardized method of approach, and the guidelines have helped case flow quite a bit, and this was done together with the magistracy. We've also now received 20 million people of our people still managed by the traditional system of justice. You would note that it's quite a large, sizable population, and we find a lot of domestic violence within the traditional system of justice, and together with the National Prosecution Authority have this ongoing project of Ndabizita, which looks at training and identifying issues within the traditional justice system, and so far we've had a range of almost 100, if I said, traditional leaders who've been trained on understanding domestic violence, so when and if they can resolve disputes. Because you would find when people come to our court and want to file applications, they say, I don't want you to arrest my husband or my partner, I just want you to stop the abuse. I just want, not realizing also some of the impacts of it, and also what we found, the impact on children is the worst because they constantly are seeing this, and also people are dependent financially on that particular person who is abusing. So it becomes very difficult, and one of the processes we put in place is for our clerks to be trained on managing domestic violence so they can be better equipped as to where to refer or how to intervene. And so that's really what our study has come up with. And again, I pointed out change management, intersectional social context training to understand abuse and its impact, and also a challenge that we currently have, so I'm not putting out and this is what is in place. A new challenge that we're facing is better intersectional management and coordination on domestic violence in government at large. Another issue that we're coming up with at the moment, which is still very much in the preliminary draft phase, is coming up, which we've not had in terms of this act, a policy framework. It wasn't prescribed in the act in the first place, but we, as a department, have looked at coming up with a policy that can be that can govern all of us across the cluster in terms of domestic violence. A lot of our support systems and referral, as I said, which is my last point now, is through the Victim Empowerment Program, which again is managed by the Department of Social Development. So you will see we've put out three or four aspects of it, interim housing, to look at it across the other cluster of human settlement, because of the need that many women face when they come to our courts very worried as to, and where do I go now that I've got this interdict, because I'm going to go back to my entire house. And if you look at many statistics, you will see, and I think it's a point that you raised about femicide, but a lot of fathers particularly have killed their wives and children or their partners because they would have an interdict, the frustration that comes with supporting this family whilst I can't see them, and all of that ethos and phenomena that you face in that kind of environment. Counseling and social assistance, and then medical and psychological support and assistance, as well as better coordination amongst the service providers, which the Department of Social Development is looking at in particular. But again, I point out that as a country, we have not really and closely looked at whether you be civil society, NGO, service provider, religious institutions, and government collectively looked at the causes and impact of domestic violence on our entire society. And you see it manifesting in so many ways. And if you think that the human capital of population for women is over 50%. And what we need to invest in terms of human capital and ensuring people are healthy and well. And you see it manifesting, I mean, you see it in your work environment manifesting in ways that are not really coming up with us being as productive as we could be. So I leave this part of the presentation on that note. Thank you, Shay.
Thank you very much. We will now open for discussion, clarity, concern. And I would just like to draw to the members' attention. Let us, while interacting, take note of the slide on page 5 as to. We need to ask ourselves as to why do we pass laws and they take so long to be implemented? So we need to check where's the loophole. Is it from outside as legislatures or is it from the department side? So sometime in your presentation you spoke about the Children's Act and you said you didn't have a budget for that. Something like that, did you? So members, I'm just drawing your attention on slide 5. I want to drop dead when I hear the act will come into operation on the 1st of April 2010. Mm-hmm. And we are under tremendous pressure from civil society. Mm-hmm. They are putting so much pressure on us, wanting to know why. Why hasn't this legislation been implemented? Mm-hmm. So for us to tell them that the act will be implemented in 2010, I want to hide my head in shame. I don't know how we are going to deal with this. What we need to pick up perhaps is we need to check because we have this legislation that would involve you people as justice and at some stage it involves the police. Like in this case, it's the Justice Department and the social development. So we need to check, where is the delay from? Is it from justice or from social development or from us as parliament itself? Let me not say much. Can I open the floor for questions from members, concerns, discussions? Let's have the first member will say one. Just jot down two. 3, 4, 5, 6. Let's take those hands for now. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. Let me also thank the good presentation. My question is related to these indicators. I heard the president say that we have indicators, but all these departments that are dealing with this act that involves children and whatever, they have different priorities. They differ in terms of their priorities to deal with this matter. My question is there any space for this department, all of them, to meet at some stage and discuss thoroughly this act? Secondly, Chair, is there a committee? Secondly, Chair, is on page 9. The presenter is always talk about the percentage, like it said, non-custodial sanctions have decreased sentenced children in detention by 50%. Mine is a little bit worried because every time when you hear about the percentage, you not know exactly how many, because this percentage, as you never done any or do any mathematics whatsoever. It's very difficult.
What you are trying to say is moving from what to what?
Yes.
Just get
50%. Yes, you see those things. So we are not going to accept. I don't know whether the presidents also talk about the budget for its own department about this. How much budget do we have to run this particular act that we talked about here? Those are the questions from me. Lastly, when I read the Sunday Times this past Sunday, I found a slot that says about 11,000 children are arrested every month. And whereas that is it's true, and can department say something about that, because they talk about many things here. So I'm concerned about those things, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say that while I found your presentation very good, it was quick, and I found that you assumed that we had a lot of background knowledge. Mm-hmm. Now, perhaps that assumption is wrong. On my part, I'm new to this committee, and I know there are plenty of other members who are new to this committee and who don't actually know, have all the detail that you've had before. For example, I personally would like to have a copy of all these acts, whatever they are, so that we could go through them. I don't know whether everybody else is at a much higher level than I am, but I'd like to say that I think we need to go back so that we can really understand. Certainly in the field, I have encountered all these problems, but I think as the Oversight Committee, we perhaps need more information and would love to have the background, your references to this refers to so-and-so, training has been done. I'd love to have those training documents. I would like to know what the magistrates know, what the police know, so that when I get into my constituency and I hear complaints, then I can realise who's telling me the truth. So I don't know if that's possible, but this is my big concern. I'm intensely interested, but I feel a bit overwhelmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Jefferson. Thank you for the presentation. It was quite useful to me. Secondly, the last speaker, that some of us who are new in this committee, we don't understand exactly the act itself or the bill. But then I'm sure I'm ignorant on some of the issues, but I'll ask them. You know? But then when listening, I sense that seeing that in this country we're lacking social workers and the Justice Department itself, it is a must. You must work in conjunction with the social department. So don't you encounter any problems specifically when coming to identify such children? Is there anything you are doing to assist the Department of the Social Department to get more social workers in the country, because that would help again the workload we are having in the department? That's my first question. Again, we have in the country these schools which are called reformatory schools, you know. I didn't hear you mentioning them, and these are very few in this country, and we're lacking of such schools. And when you go to such schools, you don't get exactly which department is involved. We find that education is there, justice is there, correctional service is there. When you sit down and analyze, each one passes a bar to each other. You know exactly. I want to know exactly what is your work, what is your role as a department on those such schools. And are there any in future for you to see to it that more schools are being built, because we really need such schools in this country? Because you'll find that a child is from another province is transferred to Johannesburg or another, because we are lacking such schools. Then one other question for me is the trauma centers. Is it under your department, trauma centers in the police stations? Because we find that children or women In some of the police stations, we lack such trauma centers. If they are there, they are not adequately kept. You find that during the night, there's no one. Yet, the incidents are happening more during the night. I'll stop there for now. Thank you, Chair.
Let me remind members. We are all new members here in this committee. This is a new, brand new committee.
Yeah.
Can I remind you? We are all new members in this committee.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation you just gave to us now. My question is, and it's really a concern too, are the children's courts accessible to disabled persons and persons with special needs? That's the first question. And on the budget part of it, according to the briefing by the Department of the Select Committee on Women, Children, and Persons with Disabilities, it presented the following budgetary allocation for the implementation of laws, namely Sexual Offences and Related Matters Act 2007, which is 25.5 million. And on Children's Act 2005, it's 19,101,000. On Child Justice Act 2008, 2,848. What the committee really wants to know is, are these amounts based on the low-cost scenario or full-cost scenario? Hence, will the department be able to implement these laws comprehensively? Are these amounts ring-fenced? And the department also indicated to the select committee that it requires at least 300 million to start implementing the Children's Act comprehensively. Given the shortfall, what will the allocation actually cover? And what strategy is in place to ensure adequate funding is obtained? Thank you.
As we go along, I use my powers as the chair. Honorable Makubane, you spoke about the lack of social workers.
Mm-hmm.
It's for us, partly as this committee, to raise such issues.
Mm-hmm.
I raised it last week with police that we need to make government aware of the little salaries that have been paid to social workers. So they will not come on board because they are not paid well. We need to, you know, to raise that awareness to the powers that be that we are having a problem. Social workers are underpaid. Hence, we cannot do 1, 2, 3 because nothing attracts them to come to the field.
That's okay. Thank you, Chairperson. My first question is on page 3, where you speak about the, integrating the sexual offences court into the mainstream. I think it's bullet point number 2. I would like to know if you are going to mainstream the sexual offences court. How are you still going to ensure specialisation? Because what comes to mind is the CPU, the Child Protection Unit, that was taken away and it is coming back now again. Won't you have the same problem in the long run? That is my number one. Then I'd like to look at my next question is on within all the northern areas normally of our country, like I come from Port Elizabeth. We normally have children that work for the drug lord. And that is problematic to us. Now I'd like to know, because we do have restorative justice. But many times these children's offences are very big. Because they are the children that are also
Now I'd like to know, what are we going to do about that? Because I know the correctional service, the correctional center at St. Albans is very full with our children under 18 years. Then the other question that I was interested in is the turnaround time when it comes to cases. Because the person read a lot about it in the papers. Because I spoke to the prosecutor, that's in, the person in charge in Port Elizabeth. So it says the court has a turnaround time of 60 days. We are saying that's been completed. But I would like to know, what timelines have you got in place? You know, a total case to go through the court, whether it's the regional court or the high court. Because my problem is, when it comes to the witnesses, they die. Or they can't remember, you know, things like that. So, yes, and I would like to know the timelines. Because I think when it comes to these things, you need to have timelines. Because just last week I read again, a woman was like 3 years ago. And it's still going through the High Court. But now I'd like to commend you. You know, although we have all the problems, on the one stop center. We are away in Port Elizabeth of Narina House. Narina, the one theatre of Narina House, we still call it Narina House. And I want to say that we are tracking the cases that go through them. And seeing that UCT is sitting here, there was a student when he was at high school that committed a fake offense. He went through restorative justice and he completed his degree, science degree at UCT. I'm just mentioning one. So it does help. And then the other step of worrying problem was last week I was told by the Victim Empowerment Center. Look, we have the interim patient in the interim housing. And you say you are going to have discussions with the Department of Human Settlement. And I'd like you to make another proposal to them when it comes to this. We have the Victim Empowerment Center in Utrecht. The abused women go through the center. But now they come out, they can't go back to the abuser. Now my problem is, and therefore they found me, where do you send that woman? Where do you set up that woman? So I think a person has to grapple with that question, because I had to turn to the churches actually, to ask the churches, can you help us in this situation? I think that is all. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and let me also thank Department of Justice for their very brief presentation. I just want to echo the words that was said by the one of the speakers there to say, you know, I think as members of Parliament, our work is that of an oversight. Our work is that of an oversight. And for us to be able to do that oversight, we have to be well informed, you know, the details. You know, throughout this document, like she said, someone who is familiar with this work can be able to understand. But for you to go out and explain, by the way, we are representing the most, you know, the poorest people, that do, you know, the vulnerable ones, the women. And it is our duty as members of Parliament to go out and explain to them, you know, what is happening. Because some of them are, don't you know, they are ignorant. Mm. If we can be ignorant, how much of those women, especially those who are in the rural areas. You know, this is very brief. We don't have actual figures. Where are they reflected? In which area? I think one of the issues that was also raised by one member is that the cases that we are handling, I think it's important for us to know how many cases in various cases, mm-hmm. you know, for us to know how many cases we were able to handle mm-hmm. and also the period within which you were able to handle those cases. That is very important to us. That is the information that we need as members of parliament, so that we can also enable us to explain to our constituencies. You also, in your presentation, spoke about the equality court, which you use, you know, for children. One understands, you know, there's a limitation of the infrastructure that you are operating. But is it really suitable for helping, I mean, children's cases, those equality courts, because it's not meant for them. One also empathize, you know, with the fact that the budget also that is allocated, it's not enough to handle the case. And if you look at the time that you are calculating that, you know, to have had the budget, it's unacceptable because therefore you won't be able to do your work, the most important work that you must do, because when you talk of children, when we talk of women, those are the sectors that are very important when it comes to us doing our exercise, I mean, oversight. The status of maintenance. You know, ever since we've had this child grant, it looks like, you know, it has gone down. You know, these girls, they just go loosely. The pregnant girls, they go loosely. Girls are the ones who are now looked upon as perpetrators, because now, you know, if you are a girl, you fall pregnant. Simply you go, you wake up in the morning to go and do this, to go and apply for the grant. What about the maintenance? What about the boy that is that law no longer in operation, you know, of ensuring that they maintain their children so that they can stop going around making children. And then I also want to agree with the fact that, you know, I think we need collective working within departments. It's very, very, very much disappointing to hear a comment that you made that, you know, our country has not been able to collectively look into the impact of domestic violence. At this point in time, we would have expected departments to be able to work together, because she mentioned also that you spoke about human settlement, that you will be meeting with them. You know, that is very important, because this is what we are trying to do, to ensure that it happens in Parliament. Integration, integrated planning, integrated implementation. Thank you, Chairperson.
Can I just also touch a bit on the equality court? We need to promote those courts. Because how many of us, or how many of people out there know about these equality courts? How many? Very, very few. And also, I'd like the department to understand as to how we function as members of parliament. You need to understand how we function. You see, as we sit here, all of us, we all come from different provinces. Gauteng, Northwest, KwaZulu-Natal, Eastern Cape, and so forth. Now, the member next to me is from Gauteng, for example. She needs to understand exactly, you know, how to answer to those people when she's married. But, of course, we cannot totally put the blame on you, because perhaps if I would question you, how long are you in the department, when you tell me you just started. So it's a legacy, you see. So we are also confronted by this problem. I mean, if you only now at this stage say you are in discussion with the Department of Human Settlements. You have not discussed. You are in discussion. Mm-hmm. That's a problem for us. The discussion may take a year. And how long have we passed the Domestic Violence Act? And it's only now that you're in discussion. I was going to be happy if you were saying, we have discussed with Human Settlements, and this is what they have said. That's what we want. And let us give you a chance of responding. But also, you shouldn't be offended. We are not, you know, being personal. You just need also to understand our role. Just to play our oversight and understanding issues and being able to. Because we are, as members of parliament, we are also accountable to our electorate. Mm-hmm. That's how you must understand it.
What I forgot to ask, but I marked it off here, page 11, when it comes to the National Register for Sex Offenders, there are two registers. Because you get one in the Children's Act, and you're getting one for the We Have Social Development. And I serve in that committee too. And they're having one here. So, how are you going to me, it's an anomaly, because how are you going to integrate the two? So that it's used effectively and efficiently. Because remember, many people are going to work without registers. Thank you.
And let me ask a veteran, can you also tell us how much do you need in order to put that register together?
Chair, I'm going to take some of the questions. We'll alternate and then see if we haven't left out certain questions. And certainly, Chair, I think we take it in the spirit of services we're delivering for us as a country, and respect most certainly, and in fact, I welcome the engagement with us, because there are times, especially when you get the questions from the constituencies, that our services may be organized in a particular way, and perhaps it's not being delivered in the way it ought to be. And so on many occasions, we have members of the committee calling us to tell us that, you know, you said, in fact, with the Justice Committee, we were always called. We were doing an oversight in a particular jurisdiction, and we found the following. And we would normally then intervene as long as we had the detailed information, and then come back with a response, not always before when coming before you, but purely because you have a constituency and you want to see that the services are developed. So that's always quite welcome. And also, if I may note, and this is not because I'm Gauteng based, but we've generally found that in some, it's been very helpful to committee members when they are in their constituencies during your constituency time. They it's not uncommon for them to call on the department to say, we're going to be in a particular area, if somebody could assist us, and also take you through the business processes so you understand also, and I'm not assuming that you don't, but you see firsthand what's happening and also make your kinds of comments and also understand better from our perspective when we're raising certain points. The other one is, I think it was a generic point in terms of information, and I do apologize if it seems very brief, but I think I was saying to Mr. Gianni, I wasn't sure how much time I had, so I was trying to get through as much. In fact, I thought I took too long, because normally we're given 15 or 20 minutes to cut across four or five areas, which, because we're dealing with the area, it's our bias, so we want far more time. So if that did create a little bit of a gap, it's really not intended, it's really an apology, and I think in the future we would look at it differently. But what I may suggest in that regard is, because the Child Justice Act is fairly new in terms of implementation, it hasn't come into effect, and I think, Chairperson, and I'll try and couple some of the questions if I can, that act is legislated for that it would come into effect on the 1st April 2010. And one must distinguish the Child Justice Act because that act deals with children in conflict with the law, as opposed to the Children's Act. And that is why I was saying this is one of the unique features of the Child Justice Act, in that we inverted the date of implementation when it went through both houses of parliament. And that's something committees can take note of if they're dealing with bills, as to ensuring that the date of implementation, depending on how they decide, is inverted in the act or not, because sometimes it's a minister's prerogative, which is the case in the Children's Act. So, and because it's not our, we're not the lead department, that's an issue that has to be raised with the Department of Social Development. So really speaking, I was making the suggestion that because this act is new, we are going to be running several sessions on just the implications and understanding the act better. And I think it will take us a long way also if the members wanted to join in at some of those sessions that we'll be running throughout this year, so that when it comes to the oversight, you also engage with the provisions of the act, how they operate, and also then we have had in the past different, either the National Council of Provinces committees, as well as the national committees, like yourself, coming and invite you to when we take, or when you on your oversight visits, because the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development last year undertook oversight visits to the two one-stop centres, and they looked at some of the diversion programs. So that also helps, not just knowing the act itself, but also see the business process. And in fact, what was very funny is the Portfolio Committee Chair for the centre said, don't let anyone know that we're coming, because they make the place all pretty and clean, and so we can't really see what's happening. And that was our instruction, and so we didn't inform anyone at the time that we were coming. But funnily enough, the driver who was going to pick all of them went around to check the route out and said, oh, tomorrow I'm coming with all these MPs. And so it was very funny when we got there, and I was like, geez, everything looks very organized. Oh, no, the driver was checking the route out yesterday, and that's how we knew you were coming. So I was just sort of an anecdote at the beginning. But it's not uncommon for that to happen. I really invite you, especially when you're in your constituencies or on visits that you may wish to undertake to different parts of the country on services. And also what we've done with previous committees, when we have discourse sessions or when we have some conference or engagements, we invite the committee, and we've done by Social Development for the Children's Act, where we invite members of the committee to just come to the conference also, and then depending on your availability and who you send as a committee, people attend, and it makes a huge difference because they've made presentations as well. And once or twice, I think we've also included members of Parliament in some of the investigative trips that we've taken abroad to see when we're developing legislation. And so it's something that we did for some issues, also before bills go through, to just sensitize you to what the generic issues are, without saying this is what you must promote in the bill. But here's the generic issues, here are the phenomena. So when you're making the decision of passing a bill, here's the information that you may have, and have independent people present. So that's just some recommendations in terms of our engagement, so that we don't have the situation where I'm feeling like I would explain, but where I can in the questions, I will. If I may then go into the first question with respect to indicators, I was saying that because this committee is has sat together, we've used the indicators based on the UN indicators for child justice. You'll know that there's a UN committee that looks just on the rights of children, and they've come up through various years of research and looking at countries across the world in terms of reports that they present, what are the generic indicators. And I was saying that we have contextualized those indicators because they were a bit too generic for our standards, and so we contextualize them for South Africa. Now, you won't see those indicators yet because that's what we must table before you later in the year, and that is why I was saying that when we've developed these now, because it's still in the process of tabling, still in the process of development, a lot of which we've gone ahead, but we're not ready to present that to you, and we don't need to be until December 2010, but it's across and it's done with the different departments, so we avert this issue that you raised, that different departments have priorities, and I was saying that's how it used to be done, and this is how we now have organized it. We've done something similar as well with the other areas and sectors that we work in. With respect to the 50%, on average you have, and I'm sorry, that statistic does stand a little out of context when you say 50%. On average at the moment we have of children detained on sentence, 1,100 per month. So it could, that figure could cut across. In fact, that number's now decreased by 50% to that amount. So and we've measured this figure from 2005. So in 2005, obviously you'll multiply that 1,033 on average that we have monthly. The budget, and you also raised the article, on average, these were the statistics we presented when we were before the Portfolio Committee of Justice and Constitutional Development, in the development and the passage of that bill. On average, we have at least 11,000 children being arrested and charged. That's the figure of SAPS. It's not really our figure. It comes from them. But, as I said, within 48 hours, that figure is reduced by 50% because they would have sifted through, is this a child in need of care? Is this a child who needs referral services? And it's required in terms of the Probation Services Act that within 48 hours children are assessed. That's a legal requirement. It usually is done. When it's not done, a complaint like that will come to the Provincial Committee on Child Justice. And if we then find a trend of maybe maybe Cape Town City Centre as an example. Mm-hmm. I always know to use the city centres because the infrastructure is always better. But just hypothetically, if we found Cape Town's not doing the referral, the assessments within the 48-hour period, the National Committee would then zoom in because clearly there's a policy problem or maybe there aren't social workers, etc. But it's very quickly referred to, especially on child justice, we have a very quick rate, response rate. So when you asked about the 11,000 children, that generally is. And that is why the point was raised, how many children, and that's also part of why the review in the Child Justice Act is there. How many of the children, because our approach has got to be an interventionist one. How many children are children in need of care? Are we as a country promoting that children go through the child justice system, or do we then respond to them from a social perspective? And if you look at the thrust and the ethos of the bill as well, it looks at which numbers of children, that is why you have that age of criminal capacity as well, which must be reviewed in 5 years, how many children are actually children in need of care as a result of socioeconomic circumstances? I think that covers most of the honourable members' questions. And you raised the issue of budgets, which I'd like to deal collectively when I discuss all of the other budget issues. I think with the second question, ma'am, I gave some recommendations, and again, the apology notes for that. With regards to the third question on social workers, that obviously is a Department of Social Development responsibility, and I don't mean to say that in terms of shifting the responsibility, but I think as far as I know, and I don't speak with any amount of authority, we're not the department responsible, but in our discussions with them and what they probably presented to this department, because this has been raised countrywide, not just within a department, as to how to ensure that we have further social workers, especially probation officers. And what the Probation Services Act has done is it's expanded the pool of social workers by ensuring that you have auxiliary social workers. So right now, a social worker, probation officer, is the officer in court who presents the report, but that social worker, probation officer, would be supported by auxiliary workers, and auxiliary workers are people who are still going through their degree but have had a minimum amount of training as required by the social work discipline to expand on the numbers of social workers. But that, again, is with the greatest of respect, I prefer that you take it up with the Department of Social Development because they have put quite a strategy in place and I would be out of turn in speaking on their behalf. With respect to the reform schools, I think you're very correct when you say we just don't know where this needs to be. Not because we don't know, but you would know from the curriculum and the ethos and the MTSF of the Department of Education, you would know that services, as I said, were quite fragmented. In fact, on the Intersectional Committee on Child Justice, you only had the historical criminal justice departments represented. So you would have SAP, you would have Department of Social Development, Correctional Services, National Prosecuting Authority, and the NPA. Now we've expanded the committee to include the Department of Home Affairs, who's not traditionally in the Justice Club, the Department of Education, and to a large extent, and I'll come back to the children used by adults to commit crime, also the Department of Labor, because we services run across these departments. The Department of Education has historically been tasked with the responsibility of putting up those, what we used to call schools of industry, as well as reform schools. And reform schools were for children who were sentenced, but need not have gone into prison, but would go through a reform school program to help them. Obviously, the language as well was not as restorative because you need to be reformed. Your crime was not as intensive or serious as another crime that enables, allowed you to go into prison. We only have four functional ones in the country. Part of the, and there was a decision by the Department of Education, again I'm speaking out of turn for another department's line function responsibility, but what the, to ensure that there's better integration and better services, the Department of Social Development is now taking over the responsibility, and in terms of the law, they have a two-year period, in terms of the Children's Act, a two-year period in which to ensure this integration and this handover process takes is complete. So right now it's between, and that is why you have the challenge of which department. They're still running the four reform schools, but this will all be subsumed under child and youth care centers. Now one has to also premise that against the ethos of restorative justice. If you look at the Child Justice Act, in terms of, I'm just not having the sections in my head, and I think with whatever else we may wish to send, I'll put them with the section number so that enables you to make reference. We have a major diversion program and a very major non-custodial program. And the idea is not to detain people in institutions, because the challenge of having more institutions is you've got to fill them up. So the idea is to have more programs, which need not be in an institution-based, but where children can, because the idea is not to have them come back in a system. You know, studies always show that these are universities of crime become, you get popular students coming back. So if you are in an institutional environment, you end up coming back. So enabling children to still stay with their families, depending on the assessment and the presiding officer's decision, staying with their families whilst carrying out their sentence. So the ethos of this act is not to, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't have at least one reform center or however child and youth care centers would be organized, but that you have more programs assisting them as opposed to putting them in a facility. And I think there was a point raised about non-custodial. I just wanted to say, well, I guess different departments was a point of the different responsibilities, and perhaps what we could do is in writing send to you beyond this where the different facilities are, so you have the provincial breakdown and the carrying capacity of each of these facilities that are there. With regard to the trauma centers that was questioned, those are predominantly, they're not run by the Department of Justice. And I'm not sure if you're meaning the trauma centers or the Tutuzela centers, but if it's a trauma center, it would be the prerogative of the of SAPS, not of the Department of Justice, because it's their infrastructure. And I just stand corrected on if you mean the Tutuzela, because the Tutuzela centers, the trauma centers are VEP, Social Development, which is housed in SAPS. Run collectively by the two institutions. What we could do is, which is some of the concerns, just take it up because we sit on the victim empowerment program cluster with where social development department is the lead. With respect to, I think there was a lot of questions raised on budgets, which I'll come to in one cluster response. Mainstreaming of sexual offences. I think that's becoming quite a point. And with the department's policy position at the moment, you would know that there were some, at least 53, I think, sexual offences courts dedicated to managing only sexual offences. What this caused was that if you were in Northern Cape, as an example, you would have to come all the way to Kimberley or to Upington to access a service. The idea is to have specialized services again, and worldwide the phenomena is that you get better services. It's not so much the institutional infrastructure that makes the difference, as opposed to the appropriate training programs and the appropriate personnel who have got specialized training. So if we have specialized training and services, and a requirement that, and I'm not saying that is in place, that's what we're discussing to see cost-wise which is more feasible, and this is what our studies have also come up to show, is that it makes accessibility to specialized services greater, so that you don't have it in the bigger, because if you look at our 53 courts, it's in the bigger city centers, but then the rural, more marginalized area becomes difficult to access that service. And I mean, if you just go to Kimberley, those members who come from the Northern Cape, you will realize that it takes up to 2 to 3 hours, sometimes 4 hours, by taxi of a mother and a child coming through. Now, our court fees, as an example, would give you witness fees for the day. Now, what happens if your case is postponed or something else happens and you can't, your matter can't go? But you go back with your child, who's already been raped and traumatized, together with you as a mother, equally traumatized, go back a 4 hours, ride back home and then come back the next day. So we've almost had to make provisions which are not even in our current structure to enable that service. It makes it more accessible that you're closer. I mean, that's a gender issue, transport issue, which maybe this committee could take up just countrywide, of how you enable people to just get the access to services. So when one looks also at the child protection services, it's a question of, because that was a similar phenomena, to look at the way they came out many years ago, they were also covering only a certain population. It evolved over time, and again, it's a question of, which is what we're already looking at, what is best model for us in terms of specialization of services as opposed to infrastructure. Issues of children used by adults, as the Honourable Member was talking about in terms of drugs, there's a provision in the Act which talks about children used by adults to commit crime. The common acronym we call it is PUBAC, because it has been recognized at least 50% of our crime currently within the criminal justice system is by children in the studies that we've conducted. And I can make that very clear. We've done the study in only 3 areas. In those 3 areas, we found that 50% of the children of crimes committed were with adults because they get lighter sentences. They get used. In fact, we found persons with disability used far more to commit crimes because they don't comprehend as much as a child who is able-bodied and can figure out, I might be getting myself into trouble. The other point to raise about the drug issue is the substance prevention and substance abuse law, which Honourable Member would know is a portfolio committee which just changed the law last year. It expanded it to look at drugs and how we manage drugs. There's also Central Drug Authority, which must table its report. So a lot of that is linked to child justice. I think there was also a question on the accessibility to children's courts. We have 366 magistrates' courts, and of course the children's courts are located in the general magisterial districts. We've now come up, and unfortunately you would know we had a judgment where one of the courts were not user-friendly for someone on a wheelchair. And so obviously our blue, remember the old courts, we've inherited old buildings, old courts do not provide, and some of the renovations are not even, can't be allowed, it's such that you can't make some sort of intervention. In most cases, and our blueprint at the moment, looking at how we upgrade that. And unfortunately, I'm not the person dealing with the facilities, but we could always send that information to you on the plan that we've put in place to ensure that they are as accessible. Now going into the question on the turnaround times. And here for the turnaround times for child justice. We've got a specific one, and I just lost my notes over here. It's 3 to 6 months. if I recall, 3 to 6 months for children in the district courts. We so far have 100% success rate. And I urge members where you find that a case is going beyond that, provided, of course, because it isn't just generic, it depends on the nature of the case. And usually find the cases that take a whole lot longer are complex in charges. It's not just one charge. It would be 2 or 3, and it would be very serious crimes, depending on how the prosecutor would interact with this. And then for the regional courts, we've got a 6 to 9 month rate of return. And then with the high courts, it's 9 to 12 months for children. So for children particularly and vulnerable groups, but this is more for child justice, you find the cases are prioritized. All children matter are prioritized. I think I'll take note of that. Mr. Jenner will also deal with just our case flow from a court services point of view generically. With respect to the human settlement and the discussion that was raised, I was saying that this is from the review of the Act, which we only did last year, unfortunately. And I also want to recontextualize my point about us as a country, not just as a government department, because I think just for all of our issues, it can't only be government. It's all of us collectively putting our resources. But the time has come, I think, in our country where we just need every hand on deck to assist because of the phenomena that are hitting us in terms of making us not such a well country when you look at vulnerable groups. And also we have to recognize the trauma that we faced in the last, some people might debate 300 years, but the last 30, 40 years of apartheid has manifested itself in so many ways, and you see it worse with the sexual violence and domestic violence. So one can't ignore that, and one has to also look at psychologically how we reconcile that and acknowledge it so that systems enable it. So when I was saying domestic violence hasn't been looked at in terms of the studies, as much as we do studies to look at efficiency, I was saying globally there isn't a study or countrywide which looks at the impact of domestic violence from a human capital, from a workplace. So it was in that context. Remember, we manage the bill only from a justice, and we were saying we need a more causal approach to managing domestic violence as opposed to how many cases are we processing. For me, that's the wrong entry point, as opposed to let's stop the cases if we can manage them. So, yes, our discussions with the new clusters now, you realize they've been changed around, and that's what's come through from our study as to, I think the point was raised, once I've done my interim period of time through VEP, permanently, where do I go? What do I do? You can't go back to that same environment, and that is the context of saying we need to discuss further with human settlement. How do we take this forward? Because we've not looked at it in that way, as you've rightly put out. And our study has come up with this is what we need to look at. And it also comes up through rape and sexual offenses, because you find a lot of crime committed because the infrastructure is not properly lit up. You would have to walk through a park sometimes, or through areas where you can easily be put in a situation where you come into harm's way. Well, lots of questions. On the issue of the maintenance, I think, on the child, I think one has to look at maintenance. Maintenance is different to the child grants which government gives for persons who have children, and that's a grant given by the Department of Social Development. Maintenance, which is managed by the Department of Justice, is very different. You launch an application. It's not a grant that government sets aside for you. In terms of the Maintenance Act, if you in a relationship, you've had a child with someone, you then apply to court, and there's the usual court processes that take place for you to get the maintenance. A sad fact that we have is that many women come through our courts assuming that there's a grant that will be given. So we still have a grant that will be given, which is called the maintenance grant, not knowing the services. So the point is raised. And I think countrywide, we're not just in terms of our literacy rates are high. Legal literacy is also very high. And to just deal with that, we put up different information sessions, which we piloted, and we will roll out in the next year and a half so that we have that information at clinics, etc., to say, here's how you get a maintenance grant, because that's very often confused. And then, I think, if I go to the... Sorry.
I think you are missing a point here on the maintenance act. Can you make a follow-up?
Okay.
I just didn't understand the question properly. We understand that it's the maintenance and the process that you must go through. It's not a grant.
Yes, I've also decided to query something that's mentioned. In my constituency, I've encountered many people who... Right. There are many cases where maintenance is not paid by husbands who have divorced their wives. And I think this is a tremendous problem as well. So often there is deception, and, you know, the process is slow, but you end up with people who were comfortably able to survive previously suddenly landing up to a situation where there's no food on the table. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a major concern as well. I don't know if you've got any answers on how we can tighten that up. That's a real problem. Just one other follow-up. I don't know what a tutu zela set is. If you could perhaps just tell us about that. Thank you.
If I may take the two collectively, firstly, I think with the maintenance, just on the issues, since we've had, of course you would know we weren't automated before, and we've put up a major infrastructure on automation to ensure that also people, because that was part of the challenge, is not just the process, payment of money is going directly through the electronic fund transfer to people. So that has had a major turnaround in the last 2-3 years because most of our systems are automated. What was constantly happening was monies would go into the department, monies and trust, it has to be classified, and then it would go out, and it took a while before you got your money. So with the we call the program the JDAP program, and perhaps we could just send some of the information and even pick up at another session when we come before you to just explain how that system works, because that's been our major turnaround, where you then can just get the money deposited or goes into your account. So there's a range of options that you can choose from. That's just the business perspective. What we've done now to alleviate some aspects, and again we've done a review now of the maintenance, because that also incidentally was 10 years, we haven't quite finalized the results on that study, to look at business process-wise what we can turn around and change, because that act was in process for so long. One of the pilots that we did over a period of 7 to 8 months was we found the acrimony when the partners would not pay the maintenance amount, people would come through to the class, and we found class resolving disputes without appropriate training. And what we also found in the best interest, from the best interest of the child perspective, is when these payment of monies weren't happening between the partners, the children were either used as, you know, go-betweens, or acrimony was setting in. So we did a whole series of courses for our class to resolve the disputes and assist them intervene. And we found that the rate of return was so high that acrimony was almost being prevented by people not going through the full ambit of the process, but actually talking to each other so they don't have to go through that whole process and have that as a difficulty. So we will be rolling out that. Unfortunately, we only did that in the last year and a half as a view to reforming that as a system. But still, you have those pockets of challenges. And I think where you have those and issues not being resolved within a period of time, to just give us those, and we get people calling us, and so we intervene with either the area court manager, etc. But still, it's a challenge, and I think it would be, once we've had our review in terms of the study, we'd make better, different interventions, take into account also some of the more modern technology. That was on the maintenance. I hope I've covered that. The Tutuzela centers are these one-stop centers, which has been predominantly managed by the National Prosecution Authority, but in a clustered way. So if you've been a victim of rape, there are certain centres around the country, and we've got some information on that, and we'll provide that to you, where you would have medical people on the premises. So the minute you walk into that centre, the appropriate types of medical information is taken so that you enable a better prosecution. You will know our prosecution rate on criminal offenses is not as high as it ought to be because a lot falls through in not having the right evidence. Unfortunately, we're an accusatorial system, not having the right evidence before you, and so you can't secure a conviction. So the Tutuzela Center is meant to help you have that one-stop help service when you have experience sexual violence, and then the right, the evidence is tested and checked in a way that a prosecutor needs to secure the conviction. Because many, very often, and it's not countrywide, but very often you'd find that you know, you would have had a wash, and then you've lost all of the samples for evidence to be tested, or time takes too long, and so whatever samples you have would have been dead. You've got to have that over a period of time. If I then move on to the National Register for Sex, I think it was the different, the committee saying that the different types of registers, they test different things. And with the greatest of respect, we don't make the laws, we really implement them. And this was the decision of the committee, Portfolio Committee on Social Development, to have a register for children, and the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development to have a national register for sex offenders. The child registers are protection in nature, so you don't necessarily have to go through a trial process and be convicted of a sex offense. For the register on sexual offenses, which is the justice register, you have to be convicted of an offense, gone through a process, and or accused of a criminal offense. In terms of the Sexual Offences Act, which then lands your name on the register. With the Child Protection Register, which is managed by the Department of Social Development, it's more of an administrative register, which is managed predominantly by the Department of Social Development and the Director General for abuse of children, and you don't necessarily have to go through a conviction. So if you had a disciplinary hearing because of child neglect, if it was a sex offense, it would be a crime. But for not taking care of children properly, you could land yourself up on the child protection register. So it's really the laws and the way. For there to be a change, it would need to be a change in the law. I'm going to hand over to Mr. Gianni. I think I've covered most of the questions to deal with that. Come back to the budget, the other questions I have.
So there's another follow-up on the register. Could you try and move with speed?
Yeah.
We do have another presenter after.
I'll make quick chair back. Thanks for the explanation. But the thing is this, besides the two registers we spoke about, we still have the one in education. For educators when it comes to sex offenses. You know, now just have to look at how would you collaborate with each other? That will be important. You know, even if there's, because I asked how we use it effectively, the tool. Now I'm asking on collaboration. Thank you.
Yeah, just on the, the education one is not a register in terms of law. That register is managed by the unions, the trade unions. And when I first heard of that, I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, we sought to discuss with them how they manage that register, but I haven't been able to, as much as, because we went through the department, and this is managed by the unions, to get the kind of information, because we were equally concerned that there's another register, but it's not something that's managed from a legislative perspective by departments. So our responsibility, and I'm not saying that we don't engage with that, we've already began an engagement process, but they haven't come back to us to give us further details because this is managed by a union. So it's something that we have already commenced an interaction with, but I express my concern and disquiet about that as well. Before Mr. Gianni takes some of the questions, I think there was a question on budget. Unless I could take a break, Mr. Gianni could respond and I'll come to the issue of budget.
Well, just becoming afraid that you're going to collapse at some point in time because we've been talking quite a lot, so but we need to assist you. See, I think just I need to add a few remarks on the issues that have been raised, and I think that some of them have been well responded to. But firstly, just to apologize perhaps maybe for this presentation that we didn't make it as detailed and also to cover up, to give the appropriate annexes. So I think perhaps going back, we will sort of give you a full package of this discussions and the reference in terms of the legislation that we have made the reference to during this presentation. So we really apologize for that. But just on the issue around the indicators, I just needed to indicate that I think in terms of the JCPS as well, which I'm chairing one of that committee, which is responsible for the strategic alignment and policy alignment around all of the cluster departments. I think this is an issue that we have raised, and I think that we are managing it to ensure that in terms of determining our priorities and also in setting up indicators that there is some level of integration. We do have a strategic framework that we have developed as a cluster, which links up most of these issues and programs across departments so that when we measure them across the outcomes that we want to achieve as government and so on. So there are those details that we have in terms of our strategic document that we will also update for members to have sight to. Chair, I think on the issue in relation to the shortage of social workers, I think it is a problem that I think this country faces, and I think we feel the impact of it in the criminal justice environment as such, because you would understand that I think our approach to date has been more reactive in terms of the cluster approach. We've only been looking at crime when it gets committed, but we didn't really play a bigger role in terms of the earlier stages before crime is committed. So it's an issue that we've acknowledged, and which we have really taken the initiative to work together with the social cluster to ensure that the departments that are involved in the criminal justice area are also enabled to have that proactive engagement with the provision, with the prevention of crime, and so on. So there are community initiatives that I think we are taking on as a cluster to ensure that we do empower communities, to fulfill that gap, because part of the studies that we have said, that we have also made reference to, which are indicating the causal nature of the crime is precisely the disjuncted family, the disunity in the family area. And so it's an area that I think is a cluster as a whole. We do feel that social development needs to be given some kind of assistance so that at least we can intervene as government in that broader spectrum. But also I must draw the attention of the committee as well that there is a process that government has initiated with regard to the remuneration around of all professionals within government. It's unfortunate that I think the social workers have been looked at or they've been considered as the last professionals in that regard. I'm sure that that department, currently they are involved in finalizing what is called the occupation specific dispensation for the social workers. And I think perhaps maybe once that is announced, maybe it will be a change of the scenario, what we have currently. And so we're also hopeful, because I think as a department as well, we're also dependent on the services of the social cluster. But also the second issue which creates a possibility as government is the review of the criminal justice system. I think Cabinet about 2 years ago approved the review of the entire criminal justice system, which also involves all of the blockages that, the identification of blockages in the system. But one of those as well that we also related to was the lack of capacity around the resources that government are given. You'd know, I think, in terms of how Treasury has been resourcing the department in the past, there's been a bit of a disjuncture in the sense that the department would approach Treasury separately, but not in a collective way in terms of asking for budgets for their own specific areas. And this has had a tendency in terms of, giving a scenario that some departments were given a very sizable budget, and yet the others that are so key in strengthening the chain, the value chain, were also not given that sufficient attention. Social development is but one of those departments that, in terms of the cluster, has not received that equal attention in terms of how government resources all of the criminal justice system. But I think it's an issue that, in terms of our current criminal justice a review process that has been undertaken, we have got a 7-point plan that has been approved by government. Part of those 7-point plans also identifies the lack of capacity in terms of those departments that have not been fully, you know, given some kind of attention. Of course, in terms of its approach to date, I think the focus has been to beef up the police in terms of the detective capacity, because that's one of the greatest areas, because the concern is that we don't detect crime, and that crime, if it's not detected, it also creates wrong perceptions in terms of community. And so in terms of this justice review process, the focus now has been on the police, and I think they have received a sizable amount in this one in Shadia. And the next one in Shadia, I think the relevant other departments, including justice, social development, and other relevant departments, will then be able to be considered in terms of what kind of budget that they need to look at. So I'm just saying that I think part of the problem is the historical one, but I think in terms of the processes that government has set up, we are now more or less functioning in a way that is more integrated than what used to be in the past. So also just to add on the lack of resources around the, I think Serena has indicated the history that would come from our courts. When they were built, most of them were not made to be user-friendly, more particularly to accommodate the needs of the disabled persons. We had to ask for a special budget from government, so that we are enabled to convert or perhaps rehabilitate some of those courts to make them user-friendly. And I think I must say that we are very thankful, even though I think the amount wasn't that sufficient, but Treasury did give us money, I think, for the past 2 years, that we have now earnestly tried to look and make sure that most of our courts, we make them to be more user-friendly, to accommodate those people that are not being properly accommodated in this area. It's a three-year program, and I'm not saying that we've reached all of the courts, but we can give the statistics in terms of how much we've spent and which courts have been attended in terms of that particular program. So around the issues of the turnaround times on the, with specific reference, I think, to these methods that are under discussion here, I just wanted just to augment what the Advocate Zaid has said with regards to the turnaround time, the 2 to 3 months with regard to children. I think it is important as well that we also have to give you some information in terms of the structures that we as a cluster have established in all provinces, so that when you visit your constituency, you can interact with those structures. In each and every province, we have established those child justice forums. But among them as well, we have, the prosecution services that are also been enabled to make sure that, when children interact with our criminal justice system, that they're being identified. In fact, we've prioritized their issues. In fact, there are guidelines and directives that have been issued by the National Director of Public Prosecutions to all the DPPs, to ensure that, we identify children that are in the system and make sure that we take them quickly as possible. And hence, I think the successes that, Sherin has been making reference to. So I just wanted just to make sure that I think that we also have the same kind of information on that. But apart from this, just at a broader level, and I think this addresses the inefficiency that currently are there in the system. We do know that, I think we acknowledge that point, that the current performance of our courts in generally is not up to what everybody expects of it to be. More particularly that the turnaround time with all cases in particular takes a bit longer. And this is more, I think, apparent as you move up the ladder of the courts, starting with the regional courts up to the high courts. And of course, slightly with the lower courts, which is reference to the district courts, I think the turnaround time there has been slightly quite different from the entire courts. But what we did, I think, about 2 years ago, we introduced a system, because I think we also have to understand that we as a department, we can only influence, but we don't drive the speed at which cases are driven at the court. It's the role of the judiciary, and I think it's just, in terms of our current, constitution, we as the executive cannot influence in the manner in which the judiciary can exercise its role in terms of driving cases. We can only set up policy guidelines around this matter. So one of the issues and the initiatives that we have taken as government was to introduce what we call the integrated case flow management. In that case, that integrated process of case management has been introduced to all of the lower courts, and I say this with confidence because the introduction of the process took a bit longer than what was anticipated, but we now have guidelines that would guide each and every stakeholder in the lower courts in terms of how cases should be speedily addressed. But of course, it is a process that will undergo several changes because we only now introduce the guidelines. And our idea is that once those guidelines have been implemented quite meaningfully, we'll then be able to set up standards, what we call court performance standards for the entire country. So that when people interface with our courts, at the doorstep of our courts, they would be able to understand exactly if I've got a particular case, how long this case will take me, you know, to run. And if that case is not been finalized within the time frame that have been allocated, then I'll have got a recourse of having to answer, I mean, to ask a question exactly why that is, you know, not been able to. So at the moment, we don't have those performance standards. I think these are the issues that we're working very closely with the Chief Justice to ensure that, I think, as part of the judiciary, the transformation that is to be undertaken as well is to ensure that for their accountability, judiciary also have to have a mechanism in terms of which they interface with the public, in terms of which they get measured how they perform. So that's part one of the projects that we've introduced as a department that they would ensure this. But last, the additional issue that I just wanted to make on the maintenance method is that I think we did some time ago, I think about 5 years, we did put up a huge infrastructure on the improvement of our maintenance work. I think consequently to the legislation that was introduced to strengthen the management of maintenance matters, we also had to add some additional capacity with around our courts. We appointed what we call maintenance officers. Some of them are even qualified because some of the challenges that we had was that we have clerks that have standard 8 or 10 who are not, you know, legally informed about the issues, and that's why we then made the changes to ensure that we recruit legally qualified clerks. So we do have them in some of the hotspot areas. When I say hotspot areas, I'm talking about those areas with the high density of cases, and so we do have such people. Secondly, because the other area was around the assistance that needs to be given to women that come to court. Oftenly, women come to court with not much information about where their husband or the partner is working. And that also, in a way, had a very inhibitive way in terms of how those women get assisted. So we introduced as well what we call maintenance investigators. Those maintenance investigators do assist the women when they come to court. They just have to provide the information that they have, and then we do the follow-up. And we are also linked up with the ICT, which is actually the information connectivity that we get information through various department agencies to locate the partners and husbands. And also we do, through the maintenance investigators, we do also assist in cases where there are maintenance areas that are not being paid. We do dispatch those maintenance investigators to go and assist those women to track, you know, behind the women. Then if you could look at some of the information that we've already made, I think, to the area, you know, from last year and so on, where we've been able to recoup quite a great deal of money that women on their own would not have been able to, you know, we've been able to attach pensions, of the husbands and partners, for which, you know, people would not have been able to access, and they were able to attach also immovable and immovable property just to realize money that belongs to the kids that have to be supported. So those are some of the initiatives that I think, in terms of the legislation and background, that will also give you a great deal of it. So the last point I think is on the issue you raised around what initiatives you're taking to popularize the equality courts. I mean, in terms of our steps to date, it is true that in spite of all of these challenges that we face in the country, the cases that are being heard or the cases that are being processed in our courts as far as equality courts are concerned do not tally the kind of concerns that we're facing. In fact, we have got less cases. And so part of the issues and the plans that we have taken, I think, as government was just to try and revamp, firstly to build up the proper infrastructure to make sure that, we have fully trained, personnel to make sure that those people that are coming to court for assistance, that they can get the necessary assistance. And as the minister announced last Friday, we have now done all of the remaining district courts. And now all courts have those facilities of equality courts. and magistrates as well as the clerks have been properly trained to ensure that we can be able to discharge them. But parallel to that, because we do acknowledge that this responsibility, I think we as government cannot handle on our own. We have to get into partnership with a number of role players, including civil society. There is a program that the Deputy President announced on the 10th of December that was launched, in terms of which the department will then collaborate with civil society to populate, amongst others, issues of access to justice, and though some of them will relate to our services on the equality courts, that program, I think as at the moment, we have identified the what we call the Human Rights Foundation. It will be running that program on behalf of the department together with in partnership with civil society. It's a 200 million program, and we think that by that program as well, we'll be able, amongst others, to populate our services, including the equality courts. But around the equality courts, we've got specific programs as well that we will also make available to this committee in terms of the efforts that we are doing to populate that, the information around our services with regard in respect of the equality courts. But yeah, I think those are the issues that I just said that I just needed just to pick up and just maybe add some additional information on them. But I still maintain that I think we will be able to give the full package of this, so that I think the next engagement will be better informed in terms of exactly what we have in terms of the background information. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. This is good to question. So some of your responses have actually helped us.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I was not aware of the maintenance investigator.
Mm-hmm.
Now I know that you do have that. So our question was good in a way. We are going to close the discussion unless there is a question or comment that a member would want to ask. I will give just 1 minute for that. Honourable Grace.
Thanks, Chair. And thanks for the presentation. I just want to check whether are you using the rural areas, are you using the traditional courts as children's courts? That's two separate things. No thanks. And two, if there's no thanks, I don't have any problem. And two, In slide 3, you have discussed, you have just identified the issue of developing policy and coordinate implementation of a framework for the human rights case. And we are left with plus minus 250 days for 2010 FIFA World Cup to kick start. What are the plans, what plans are they in place in preparation for today? And with regard to the human trafficking bill.
I believe is it the Justice Committee that is dealing with the traditional court bill? How are you taking us on board as this committee?
I'm going to leave the issue of the traditional court bill because that's currently in process before the Justice Committee. Mr. Jani will take that question. On the trafficking bill, that bill has not been introduced yet. I'm not sure if it's on the legislative schedule for the Department of Portfolio Committee on Justice. And I think one has to also admit that the trafficking issues are not necessarily linked to 2010, because there is a perception that we deal with sex trafficking. There's a transitional provision within the Sexual Offences Amendment Act for the purposes of trafficking for sex. What you also find is our protective measures for children who have been trafficked in the Children's Act. So they deal with different issues for purposes of promoting and protecting children in terms of the Children's Act, but in the Sexual Offences Amendment Act, you will see that there's currently a provision in place for trafficking for sex purposes. There's a general perception that trafficking predominantly people who are trafficked are predominantly trafficked for sex purposes. And what the point that needs to be made is that trafficking happens because predominantly in Africa because of socioeconomic needs. And as a consequence, people end up, because wherever they find themselves, can't now, if they were labor exploited or migrant labor. And our concept of migrancy in Africa is also different to what the international standards of migration talk about. So those provisions are there. What already is in place is just in preparation for a bill that would come, whatever processes we can coordinate and assist with. Because there isn't, the bill has not been introduced, and once it becomes before a committee, then the necessary processes will be put in place. That was in anticipation of a bill that we put on and our MTSF so that we could prepare ourselves, because our minister raised that we would like to introduce this bill before Parliament sometime during the legislative schedule. So we'll get guidance from the Justice Committee on how that will be taken forward.
On the traditional courts bill, I think it's a matter that yesterday we dealt with it substantially at the Portfolio Committee on Constitutional Justice and Constitutional Development. And I think perhaps maybe it is also something that, you know, we didn't get a clear understanding, would have been able also to do the similar presentation here so that we can take you through in terms of what that legislation entails. Because I think there are quite a number of concerns that have been raised by civil society about that legislation. Some of them are not well placed, but it's important that I think we take you through in terms of what the substantive contents of those sections that are being sort of amended in terms of the current legislation are being, you know, sort of, you know, suggested. But I don't know how you would like us to deal with it, but I just need to maybe just give a background to say that this is the legislation that has been sort of, you know, left for a very long time, not been attended to for some time. You recall, Chair, that I think after 1994, most of the legislations, we had to do a very vigorous, you know, process in terms of looking at the unconstitutionality of some of the legislation processes. And this is what, but one of those legislation that wasn't attended to at that time. It was only a legislation that was then, I think now, recently looked upon, because the current black administration, in terms of which the Chief's Court and Headman, you know, courts operate, it's still an updated one. It's a legislation that is very problematic in terms of its own operation. And so the department is of the view that that legislation needs to be properly, you know, amended. In fact, that legislation was declared by the Constitutional Court as unconstitutional. Only two sections of it that, you know, left, you know, I think section 12 and 22 were left to be operative, just to make sure that the transition with regard to the Chief's Court is left intact until there's a new legislation that, you know, is brought about. And so that legislation, the traditional courts bill, is the one that seeks to then amend and put a new regime of our traditional courts into place. So I wouldn't go into detail unless, if Chair, you want me to go into, but I think we can be able to give you a thorough presentation on it if there is such a request.
We were just made aware by civil society that this the bill that is going on in the Justice Committee, I believe, I have not gone through it, but I believe that there is some clauses that affect women there.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what was raised in our interest as a committee. But we will interact as to how we would want you to present something on, you know, to the committee. I have been missing some voices today. I haven't heard some voices. We will close the discussion on this matter. Thank you very much to the department. We will certainly interact on some issues. So you are excused.
Thank you very much, Chair, as well, for this invitation. It's our first invitation to this committee, and I hope that we'll also work together just to you know, to make sure that I think your objectives in terms of what you seek to do, that we also, I think as part of our department as well, that we also feel part of the family of this committee as well. And I think from this initiative, I think it is something that I think we can build on in moving forward. Thank you.
Thank
you. Are you comfortable from that? Sorry. I had meant to remind you that you did not respond to the question that was raised by Maduna on the issue of the budget allocations, which is very important to us as a committee. Those amounts that have been allocated to the different implementations of the X. You haven't responded to that.
I took it as Mr. Gianni giving a generic response, but what we presented before the other committee was the following, and I must put it in the following context. These budgets were given to the department, not specifically for, in terms of how Treasury would allocate it, would say what the budgets are for. But we as a department, because we didn't receive those budgets, and also when the legislation came into effect, as what Chair was saying, how can the committees assist? When the legislation came into effect, the budget cycles were already complete, so no budget was allocated for implementation. So we as a budget department put on our own, whatever we were allocated for our justice services, the following amounts. The sexual offences for 2009-10 cycle, we put out an amount of 25.5 million. That was the slide, I think, that was presented, and we'll forward that to you. For the Children's Act. And again, I must say that, remember, as much as this is something for justice services, SAS would still have its budget, as you would get processed, so will correctional services, and so will social development. Similarly, for the Children's Act, we put aside our own 19 million. For child justice, we put 5.5 million, because we haven't again got the act only came into tabled through Parliament, which enabled us to get a budget. With regard to the cycle that we've received for child justice, and again, this was in discussions with the child justice committee at the time to coincide the implementation of the 1st April 2010 to enable us to get the budgets. And because this was a cluster effect budget, we got the following amounts from Treasury for implementation of child justice: 50 million for 2010 and 11, for 2011, 2012, 100 million, and then increment, because it's incremental over a 3-year cycle, during 2012 and 2013, 150 million. So for the implementation of the new pieces of legislation. So we would have to divide that up as well. So those were the figures. And also, if you just look at what it buys you, which is the question, I think when we come before the committee the next time, we provide what each of the services are and what they cost. I think there was the question you also raised is which scenario, is it low level, high level? You would see in terms of the costing for the Children's Act, you require in a low level scenario 300 million in the overall implementation of the Act. But at the same time, we've also got to be realistic as to that whole costing process and what we actually can afford, not just as a government, but as a country. And so for this financial year, we're only putting up 19 million, and I think the rest Mr. Gianni raised in terms of how Treasury organizes itself, and perhaps what we must do differently is when we do the next cycle of how the children's budget is managed for the Children's Act, because that is our biggest challenge at the moment.
Thank you. The presenter, Ms. Lung, is from the Mela, from the Western Cape Network on Violence Against Women. I do hope that members have this two-page presentation, but if you could just correct, we are no longer a joint monitoring committee, Lungiswa. We are now a committee on women, children, youth, and persons with disability. Yeah, if you could just correct that in future. Over to you, you may begin. I see your presentation is reasonably short. It's fine. We will listen to what Lungiswa has to say. Thereafter, we'll interact with her.
Good day to the members, and thank you, Chair. And we're also thanking the committee for giving us this opportunity that we could present the voice of civil society into the issues of, the issues of women and children, especially in terms of violence against them. And also, this is very much from the point of view of, service providers, and also representing the voices of women, especially those women in shelters for abused women. So it's totally not from a legal point of view. It's really much focusing on implementation and the challenges, and also the successes that we've experienced from it. As was indicated, I'm Lungiswa Membela from the Western Cape Network on Violence Against Women. And also apologies for coming in late. I had a personal crisis this morning. Total apologies for that. This is going to be short, and felt I, not to hold any more time. We need to commend, our government firstly, as a, in terms of looking at the laws that are in place, because in South Africa we've got one of the progressive laws in terms of women and children, and so we are very proud of that. But when it comes to implementation, there's, of course, challenges. And also we're facing a bigger issue when we're looking at, statistics. And, that is translated into a picture which is not good in terms of the issue of violence against women. Because if statistics is telling us at this point that a boy is, learns to abuse at the age of six, that is the scary picture, because it's not at a later stage we think, oh, when he's an adult, he's going, he might be an abuser. That's already too late. So it's very important as an issue that needs to be handled with that in mind. And before, I think about 2005, we had a campaign that was called Every 6 Days campaign. Because that campaign because death at that time was telling us that every 6 days in South Africa, a woman is killed by an intimate partner. But immediately, in 2 years later, we had to change the name because the stats were telling us every 6 hours, a woman is killed by an intimate partner in South Africa. So that just shows that with all the laws that we have, something else is missing. So in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, which everywhere where you would present it, really is quite a good act, as it is in paper. Where there's just 3 points that I've put in there that were, really great points, in terms of looking at a story of a woman and how that could help a woman. The first part is the fact that women, according to the Act, could be granted the shared residence. So that's in paper. So instead of women moving into shelter, the perpetrator, according to the law, could move into, could move from that house and the woman access that house. Because the good thing about that is that women, when they're in shelter, it's a big disruption for the children. because, you know, schools have to be organized for them, and, you know, transport and things like that. So it involves a lot of organizing than if it would be the perpetrator that would move from the residence. But we know a lot of women don't even ask magistrate for that, which is one of the things that I've indicated as part of the challenges. That because that is in paper and people could access it, but is there protection for them when that happens? I think 2 years ago we had a school that was in a crisis in Khayelitsha because two children were burnt into the house when the perpetrator came through the night and put the house alight, and two children died in that house. So it's that type of protection that we don't have, you know, for women and children in this country. So though there is provisions in the Act that could make the lives of women and children better. And also that the Act has broadened the description of domestic violence. You know, it's looking at it broader, and it's incorporated a whole lot of other domestic issues besides just the intimate, the between the partner, the two partners. It looks at the parents being mishandled by their children. It, you know, it's looking at also the different relationships, not really just the heterosexual type of relationship. So that's a good thing also. So those things, you know, are there. Those are the things that we, besides the main highlights of the fact that there is protection order that could be given to women that are abused, but it's also got these, you know, other things that could be accessed. So the successes as well has been that percentages of women using the protection order have risen. So though, if you're looking at the numbers in terms of the statistics, the numbers are showing that the issue is progressing, but at the same time, more women are reporting than they were before. So more women are now, you know, have learned about their rights, and they stay using their rights. Also, there's better compliance from the police than we were before. Yes, that could even, you know, be, you know, better. But it's still, you know, there's strides that have been moved from where we are, as we were at the beginning. And also compliance by the judiciary, and also support for standardized training. There was a question earlier around the trauma rooms that are in police stations. Those trauma rooms, the departments that are involved, the major department is SEF and community safety. So with the support of Business Against Crime, we as a network, we coordinate the trauma room focus group that brings all those departments together that are involved. So it's more than those two major departments, but those are the leading departments in terms of trauma rooms. So we've started, putting, because a lot of service providers have been providing training for volunteers in trauma rooms, but each organization had their different training. NICRO had their own training, Red Crisis had their own, Mosaic had their own. So the network on violence against women as a coordination body had brought in all these departments together and also these service providers together, so that we could look at the issue of standardizing the training, so that, you know, we don't have these volunteers, you know, providing different trainings at the trauma rooms. So the Business Against Crime has supported that training. And so November last year, the training was put in place, but with the input of all those service providers. Everybody had their input into, you know, what that training would entail, so it incorporates all their manuals. And at the same time, we had sessions where we had all the departments that were involved in trauma rooms, where they would put in what their involvement in trauma rooms. And also service providers did the same thing. The civil society did the same thing. But after that, we had sessions where we had personnel in trauma rooms, the police and the volunteers. We created spaces where the volunteers could say, you know, what are the things that are working for them in terms of the trauma rooms, and what are the things that are not working. And the same thing with personnel, to the extent that a border came from it, where it incorporated, because they had a very tender relationship before, where the police were feeling that the volunteers are just coming into the station and they are taking over, and they try to do their work, and the volunteers are saying, we're not getting support from the police, we can't, you know, have spaces to put our files, or when we need a phone, we can't, you know, access that. So we've also realized that because of orientation in trauma rooms, that was lacking, because if the station commissioner authorizes the volunteers, but doesn't introduce the volunteers to the person at the charge office, which is the exact person that they live with when there's a, you know, even after hours, when there's a crisis. So a model came from that, and now we've got the module for standardization of training that could be used in trauma rooms. The challenges regarding the Act has also been, as I've mentioned earlier, the lack of physical protection for women after they had the Act. Because at the end of the day, also according to the procedure, is that they have to go and give the protection order to the partner, which is you know, is very problematic. But also sometimes, even though there's a sheriff, you know, which they have to pay for, but the sheriff also isn't situated at the court, so they have to take a taxi or, you know, go where the sheriff is, so which means more resources for the women in terms of that. So there's a lot of challenges. And to mention an example also of the one specific court in Mission Place, where there's three spaces, three offices that deal with the protection order. One is when you come at the court, you have to go, they call it the Kentucky office, it's because it's just below Kentucky at the town center. So you have to go there to get a number, nothing else. You go there, you get a number. You cross the road to the court where you're going to sit with somebody, you know, the clerk, where you could table your story. And then once the story is tabled, you're given the folder, cross the road again, you know, to the court where you're going to see the magistrate. So all those are challenges that women are facing, because a lot of women have even been caught, you know, crossing the road by their partners, because they also know the procedure. So there's a lot of challenges regarding that. And also still more training for personnel, because a lot of times staff, when it comes to the training will be given to the officers, but the guy at the charge office, which is the first point of contact, you know, with the victim, doesn't always get the training. So that's a challenge that, you know, staff needs to take up as an issue, or even where the committee could help, because at the end of the day, the person who needs to know exactly what needs to happen as well is the person at the charge office, and also the person who needs to be changed, the attitude as well. Also, you know, the challenge also that bad attitude, where people in general, and in a lot of service provision, they use issues of, they bring in issues of culture, or if, you know, there are personal issues into the workplace, where a woman, I'll make an example of an African woman coming to the charge office, and the police saying, you know, how, you know, do you know how you're putting your family into, you know, in our culture, you could go to your mother-in-law, you know, things like that, which is not necessarily, you know, his role, you know, to point out. Because it takes a lot for a woman to, you know, to say, and it's rare that you find a woman has been beaten once and go to the police immediately. So when they take that courage to go there, they don't really need to, you know, to be sort of like, yeah, that will happen. And also, lack of resources to support the implementation. The Chair, you've raised, Madam Chair, you've raised the issue of, you know, why there's always the delay in terms of implementation. You know, because the acts get passed without resources being put in place, with no training for the people that are going to be using that act. So at the end of the day, it's just there and people are getting frustrated because it's been publicized as something that has been passed, and yet there's no knowledge of how it should work, and also resources put in place for that. And also the confusion between the interdicts and lay charges in terms of the domestic issues that have been perpetrated. Because now there's the trauma room. So when women get to the charge office, the police, in a lot of times, they sort of like take it the fact that there is a trauma room that makes their job, you know, much easier. They don't have to lay a charge. So because according to that, that should be a choice of a woman, that you just want the protection order, you're not laying a charge. But you could do both. So at the moment, what happens is that when you present your case at the station, they just send you to the trauma room, you know, and everything would be dealt there. And yet that's not the case, because in some cases the woman wants to lay a charge, because that has been a crime even before there was an act, that somebody that beats another woman, that's always been a crime. So those, in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, those are the challenges that we've experienced and that really make things difficult for women, especially those women in the shelter. And the Sexual Offences Act, also, you know, the fact that, you know, it has been passed and it came to be, it's also a very progressive act. And as part of it, there's the success of the Tutuzela Center, because that has been a big frustration, that the woman that has been raped has to sort of like repeat this story over and over and over at different spaces, you know, by the doctor, by the police, by different spaces, and where she needs to get counseling. But with the Tutuzela centers, in one place, they're getting all the services that they need in terms of the situation that has happened. So the police would see them there, the doctor would come and, you know, visit them there, in one place, so they have to only tell their story once. So that has been a great success. And of course, we need more of this center. There's very few. So the challenge there is really sort of duplicating them in a whole lot of other places. And it also, the act has broadened the definition of rape, you know, which now even includes objects. It includes when somebody else has been forced to do that on the other person. So there's a lot, the description has been broadened into just the penetration by a penis to a vagina. So that has helped. And also the inclusion of children as specifications on the act, and there's also the offender register, and of course there's been the challenges in terms of how do these registers get integrated so that they're supporting each other. Though they're from different departments, but how do the departments, you know, pull together in terms, because it's still one register that we're talking about, it's just done at different spaces. And the challenges regarding that is, of course, lack of practice in court, because courts are still very conservative. So, you know, it's really, you know, in a matter of how do they follow up in terms of what the Act requires. And also the lack of protection in court. So that has been looked at, which we're happy that a process is going to be put in place. It's starting to the process is starting, where there is more protection in court, especially for because when it's a rape thing, there's been, we know, in the country, also the secondary victimization, you know, for rape victims, in terms of, you know, where you were and, you know, what you were wearing on those things, and also, you know, facing the perpetrator and how it has been for victims. So that also is being followed up. The conviction rate is still not high, because, you know, though it's progressively going up, but it's still low when you're looking at the numbers of the perpetrated acts of rape and also the conviction rate. So they're not matching. And also the allocation of resources is still a challenge. In this act, then it's the TVs, especially for children in court, and also intermediaries. And I'm glad also that's been looked at as well in terms of the earlier presentation. And the training for magistrates. because if they're going to be working with this, that's a big priority that they need to know what's entailed in the act. But I think what's important as well is that they need to know the context of violence, or even the context of all these acts, you know, where things are coming from. Because sometimes that's not incorporated into the training. The training is very much about this is what you do. When this happens, this is what, you know, how you react. And yet there's more than that, you know, looking at the broader context of the issue. So what are the oversight opportunities, you know, for Parliament and this committee to engage with the Act, you know, in terms of your role. And also the Justice Committee to be monitored, you know, just so that we are able to check the things that have been said to that are going to happen, that they've been followed. And also even the steps that we've indicated, that is very old steps. So money is needed to do more research. Because in order for us to know that we're getting the right picture, we need to be monitoring all the time, and we need to get the proper numbers. So, and that's not happening. If you're looking at the website for the MRC, or CSVR, or any of those bodies that are involved in research, the research that is there is very old, because the funds are lacking to follow up on research. On the issue of femicide, we know just even that generally that has grown so much in terms of stories that we hear on the news. It's really it's been a grown phenomenon that needs attention. And also there's really not much support for women who have chosen to leave the issue, which is sometimes what leads to femicide to happen, because women are not getting enough or proper support when they leave their partners. And a lot of times, if you speak to the women in shelters, more than 90% of men coming from shelters, they go back to the situation. So what we would want to see happening is that women could go back if they want to, but they go back as a choice, not going back because of, you know, there's nothing else, because of financial dependence, because of the roof over their head, because of, you know, food for their children. So we would want to see a time where women are just going back because of they want to give their partner another chance. And so their choice is dependent on them, not because of desperation. And also, especially for the Western Cape, we've seen in the last 3 years an issue that's been growing, child murder, and those children are found, raped, and killed. That's been a serious matter that really needs proper consent to, you know, from everybody. But also, in terms of the law at the moment, it's looking at just the perpetrator. And I personally think there isn't much that's been done by parents that are neglecting their children. Because in most of the time, we know that the children, this has been done by somebody that's known to the family, either the parent's friend or a member of the community. And that has been a lot of stories that have come up, is that person has been sitting with their parents, drinking, or the child has been sent to the shop at the time, a six-year-old that has been sent to the shop to buy bread after 7. So that side of it hasn't gotten attention. That yes, the perpetrator needs to, you know, to be put to book, but at the same time, what is being done by the parents, that now that's crying on TV because of what had happened, and yet, you know, this keeps on happening, that parents are not doing their role as parents in just providing protection for their children. So that's not in terms of the act per se, but just generally that when that happens, you know, what needs to be followed up. Perhaps the parents will be referred to a parent center, you know, or to service providers that would be able to help with whatever the problem is, whether that would be drug abuse or alcohol abuse or things like that. So And also then in terms of the causal of domestic violence that I've mentioned, that because of the cycle of domestic violence, there is the cycle that is personal, which is within the couple, that the woman is forgiving after, you know, the partner has apologized and, you know, professed love and all that. But there's also the cycle in terms of the service provision that, you know, as I said, the woman keeps on going back because, and then she goes back to the shelter again and then goes back to the partner. And we know violence, after she's been to a shelter once, it gets worse because you've been sort of like clever and you sort of expose the issue of the family. So the violence that gets perpetrated after that is even worse for the woman. And there was a mention in terms of the question around the role of the church even, which I think is the community in general, but also the churches. There's so much, because a lot of people belong to some structure, some religious structure. And in a lot of times, that structure could really be there and be supporting to the person. And also, because there's no sanction of violence perpetrated to women and children, that's why it keeps on going on. When there was sanction in terms of where people belong, whether that would be in a church or in even a sports club, where people could isolate the person, or saying, you know, we don't commend your behavior, so we can't be associated with somebody like you. That would probably make it a big difference as well. So in terms of the things that I've raised in my presentation, I think it's things that where this committee could really be supporting us in those things. And also we've realized it's a new committee that you've seen me dragging back. And I think part of the question that the honourable member raised is a new committee where you felt that, you know, perhaps there's more knowledge in terms of this or even where you could find information. We've put in, because we started as a network, a new program, which is a prevention program. But it's a different type of prevention, where we're looking at this, what's causing violence, and also because we've got all these great laws, what's keeping violence against women alive when all this work has been happening for years and we're not really making that impact. So this program, we're looking at, we call it a social mobilization program, where we're looking at, we're taking a step back and looking at what are the things that could change, and in terms of changing the status quo in terms of violence against women. And we've been focusing on changing negative social norms that are keeping violence against women alive. What's making the abuser do what he's doing? And what's making the victim sometimes, you know, be in that situation, or even allowing that to be happening? Which also is a lot of things that are involved, but I'm not going to get into the program because of time. But we've prepared this, we are preparing for the media, because part of the training that we're doing this week is training media on the issues that, you know, especially the issues of gender and how they're reporting and all that. So we put this, this is the memory stick, a USB, that's got information that would refer, where you could, you know, refer to in terms of the issues. And the treaties that our country has signed in terms of these issues. So this is, so I've brought in, I think I asked maybe so I said about 13 members. So we've got about 13 of these for the members. And also, so they in this package, in this bag, that has, just think quickly, it's not a lot of things, just to show you things that you could use, because we felt that once you have these as a new committee, you are able to look at the issues. So this would be your information in this thing, and this is just a pashmina that has the question, like a small sticker that has, you know, the question on what's keeping violence against women alive. And
that was in mind. It was the question that we're focusing on. And at least I left the USB, so that's what's in the pack. And lastly, this booklet that we put together. This is our tool that we've been using everywhere. And if you're looking at the outside, this picture outside in the in this booklet, in this brochure, these books, the outside cover is different for each book. The cover is in the same, because this cover inside the booklet, this cover for this one, that's just part of the picture. So that's why then you each have a different cover, because it covers a certain part of the picture, which is the whole issue about the fact that if we are all doing this together, mm-hmm. we are able to go more further than we would individually. So this is this process, and the norms that we're targeting, the negative norms, are indicated in the booklet, and it explains, I'll get to quickly the social norms, and in the middle of the book, where got that face and with the different, so these are the negative norms that we're trying to change in terms of the program. Mm-hmm. And here is the positive norm, that if that norm would change, because it has to be replaced, you can't take, even if you take the negative one, for example, the fact that says women get beaten because, you know, if women are believing that they get beaten because that's a way of showing love, that's how their partner shows love. You know, how, if we're taking that negative norm, you know, how do we replace it with? So this is the brochure that's also in the text that you're going to have. So basically, just saying that we're really thankful that we're getting this opportunity, and hopefully we'll be able to form, this is a start of a relationship with the community, where we could feel each other and support each other in terms of the issue, which is a much bigger issue that we're dealing with, and is killing our
country at this stage. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I see members
are very keen. Could we have the first member?
One. You're paying back now. Two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine questions or comments or whatever.
Thank you, Chair. This is a very simple and straightforward presentation. My question is, I don't
like simple things. Don't complicate it.
It's just a question of the clarity about these offices or officers. Who pays these officers who are sitting in the Kentucky House and another one, because that one is just getting a number. Who pays that officer at the office, just to get the clarity on that? Because I'm aware that you are trying to get sponsors from different people like a business against crime. Thank you.
Mine is also about the offices in Mitchell's Place. Crossing the street, coming back, crossing the street again. What I wanted to say, Chair, is that it would be a good lesson for us. It's a pity that we are not going to do any oversight this year, because I thought it could be one of the oversight visits that we could take on, and it's just local, because I think it's important for us to seeing, believing, we see it for ourselves, this process. I think it's very crucial. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it on?
Yeah. On now.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is just a comment.
I want to thank Lungiswa for this paper. I think to me it has very good information. But I wish this paper could have been before the Department of Justice. I have so many questions for the department than for her. And it just shows that, you know, women and children are still vulnerable in any other way. The thing that makes me to mention the Department of Justice is that the court still being conservative, and then lack of protection in court. I don't think it goes with what we've been told now. So thank you very much for the information and for the gift that you have just mentioned. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair and Presenter. I just want to thank you so much. You have given us a one-stop shop information, and this is exactly what we need. So I'm delighted. Thank you very much for that. I'm concerned about the people who do duty in trauma centres. I'm thinking of one in Atlantis, for example, and I'm sure this is the case with many others. The people don't receive any remuneration. There's not even a stipend. Now, I think this is a problem. I think it's wonderful that people are prepared to give up their own time, and they go on these courses, and sometimes it costs them, but there's no remuneration. But as a result of that, there's also a very big turnover of staff. The minute they have the opportunity to move somewhere else, to NICRO or whatever, they leave, and you can understand that. But it does mean that there's no continuity. And very often you also find that there isn't really good quality of training. It's a kind of hit-and-miss affair. And that's not just at Lattice. There's some excellent people, but in other places too. So I'm concerned that we need to look at that. I don't know that it should just be a voluntary thing. I think we need to look at legislation so that we can improve the service, because so often, as you mentioned, the person on duty in the charge office will say, oh, that's not important, go away. And we can't have that. I know of a little child, a boy, who was raped. And he had to go to the Red Cross Hospital for a lot of medical treatment. But that child never received any counseling, nor did his family afterwards. And he went back to school, and there that child was being victimized a second time by the scholars who were mocking him. So there are lots of things that fall through the cracks, and this is why I really think that we need to professionalize this a whole lot more. Something else that concerns me, and possibly not directly with you, but I want to raise it anyway. Bail is given far too easily for serial offenders. And it's a matter of women's group organizations having to go and have a protest outside the court, a picket, or I writing a letter to the prosecutor saying, please do not release this person. That's not right. Somehow we as legislators have to make sure that this happens, or that the system is changed, or not the system, the neglect is changed. And if you or anybody else can assist with that, I really think we'll be doing a service to women in general. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the lovely presentation. When you started your presentation, I was outside, but I wanted to know whether is this the national or provincial women organization? And if not nationally, do you have any relationship with other women organizations? Because this is very important. It's very important, you know, that you shouldn't be just in the Western Cape in your corner and do things alone. It should be known nationally, more especially. Things are different from province to province. Things differ. In Gauteng, I can mention some of the incidents. In Western Cape, they're different. In KZN, they're different. Customs also contribute to these things according to different provinces. So what I'm trying to say is that it's important for you to have a relationship with other women organizations, especially those who are contributing to such events. Well, the issue of budget uncovered by honorable member, where to get money. There's this thing of that, you know, it's true what you're saying. And some women, they persevere, they have been abused for years in marriage. Abused, but one day, being a woman, you ended up killing your husband. And you are being sentenced for 20 to 25 years in jail for that. You know, that is painful. And now, when they are sentencing you, they don't go back because you have been reporting the incident, what's happening to you, the abuse which you were made. But then, when you are sentenced in the court, you are given 20 to 25 years, you become rotten in jail. You know, such things, they are so painful. One other thing I want to know, recently Parliament has passed the Act Older Persons Bill. That is very, very important, especially older women who are being abused by their grandchildren, mm-hmm. especially when they come from collecting their social grant money. Whether do you people in the Western Cape starting to implement that bill, or are you starting to educate the community about that? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair. I think the honourable member next to me has stolen my words. Yes, I was just trying to check whether how do you network with other women or organize structures of women in other provinces, because what you're doing, I think it's perfect to the issue of funding for your organization. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think mine is just a comment, and thank you again for the presentation. I think the issue of shared residence is a very good one that the perpetrator actually moves out. I love that very much. But still, don't we think that the victim might be in trouble again, because if there's no protection for that victim, really they can be murdered even before the case goes to court. I don't know. But thank you again for the information.
Thanks a lot, Chairperson. I only got one small question. Thank you too for the presentation, because I think things go far away. When it comes to what you are saying, you know, within, like, your challenges within this documentation, I think there's a lot that we can do as a committee when it comes to questions for oral reply, you know, in lobbying the minister, and it can be part of the oversight processes for the last of a few sections. Oral questions for oral reply. You know, you lobby the minister to find out you know, what are they doing about certain things? And you just do an oral question, or it could be, you know, they give you an answer in writing, or they give you oral reply to your question, and it's done within Parliament. And in that way, it's a lobbying process, which can send you satisfied or dissatisfied. So I marked up a few things here. Just here, when it comes to your, on page 2, what are the oversight opportunities? I'm not sure whether I was listening to you when it comes to the second bullet point, the Justice Committee to be monitored. You know, what committee are you speaking about? Because Justice spoke about a national intersectoral child and justice steering committee. You know, where you'll find everyone, the police, social development, and education. And that falls, you know, everyone when it comes to the Sexual Offences Act. Because I'm not sure whether we can monitor our justice portfolio committee here. So I'd like to know what oversight body, what body is that we should oversight. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Actually, I think most of my comments and questions were stolen by all these members. But however, I just want to thank the presenter for for giving us this insight, because this is very informative. And as the one member has said, that it's going to assist us also in doing our oversight work. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Can you respond, Nash?
Okay. The first question was on the process in Mr. Plain at the court. The office, which is called the Kentucky office, is where the family cases are held, like, you know, maintenance and, you know, and the protection order according. But when you come there, you only, when you enter, you just given a number, sort of like you number 10, you number on the queue. But you still have to write your statement at the actual court. So after you've gotten your statement, you come back, you are sent here with your statement where you see the magistrate. Because those cases are held on this office. But the point is, why wouldn't the clerk, you know, move to this side and you do everything in one side? So that's where the challenge is. So that was what I meant with that.
The point you are raising is the issue of being sent from pillar to post.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And because it raises an issue of safety even as well. And the trauma rooms, the question around the trauma rooms, the issue of remuneration. Yes, a lot of times that's been a biggest challenge, because there is the issue that says volunteerism is voluntarism, and we need to promote that so people are giving. But in most cases, I think in South Africa as a country, our volunteers are people that are not working, sometimes not by choice, because there isn't work. Unlike as in some countries where you find that people are just volunteering, though they've got other things, or they're not working because they've got money, but they still volunteer, you know, because they want to do something. So it's been a challenge, because then what it says is that then they're not volunteer, you know, if that's the case. But at the same time, they could be perhaps be given a stipend that would be helping them, but not necessarily a salary or a wage, but it could be a stipend that helps them at least to be able to cover their minimal cost. And the quality of training, yes, I think the issue of coming up with a standardized training exactly came from that. And so we started, you know, doing the training. We just finished the first batch in March. But that was just the first group that was trained. So it was different stations, and now it's going to go to rural areas, the training, peri-urban and rural areas. And community safety is just, I think last month, end of July, where the organization provider that could do that training had to put in, a tender for that training. Because though we, as a network, we've sort of like put the training together, the modules belong to Business Against Crime, as they pay for it. So now community safety is going to be using that module, would be given to whoever wins the tender to be able to do that training in all their stations. So by end of next year, all the stations, all volunteers and stations should have been trained according to that manual. And that the training would be the same, doesn't matter which station, whether rural, peri-urban, or urban, the training would be the same. And on the bail issue, yes, that's a big challenge, especially if you're putting that with the issue of women that end up killing their partners. Because for men, in terms of our system at the moment, it seems like the system has been very lenient to male perpetrators of violence against women. Whereas if it's a woman, women get higher sentences in South Africa. Women who kill their partners, they get higher sentences than male who kill their partners. The reason for that is that it's been, because women normally, they don't
kill the partner when they're fighting. It's either she waits until he's asleep or she gets somebody to kill him. So because of that, that has been seen as premeditated murder. So, but now the issue is that we had a campaign in 2000 where we were asking the president that time to pardon women that have killed their partners. And we were, what we're trying to say is there's the issue of the battered women syndrome. Because none of those women have been abused once and killed their partner. So we were trying to show that by the time they're doing it, they're not themselves anymore. Because some of them have been through that 25 years, 20 years. So it's been a long process where they just met and did it in most cases. So what we're doing is, you know, asking the president, of course, we didn't get anywhere. But it doesn't mean that we can give up. We're still going to try and do that. And also, while we're working with the women, we're trying to sort of like intervene before women get to that stage, which is also what we're trying to do with this prevention program, because we don't want women to snap at the end of the day. So what can be done so that they don't get to that stage? So that's a big challenge that we experience at the moment. And in terms of the whether we provincial, yes, we're a Western Cape network, so we in the Western Cape, but we work with all the structures nationally and also internationally. So we don't just, in terms of the service, we're focusing in the Western Cape, but we link in a lot of times with the other structures that are doing the same work. And we coordinate a shelter focus group, which I think is Kiki for years has been supportive of that focus group. And so from the one that was coordinated by this network and the successes of that focus group, last year in August, a national shelter movement was launched based on this focus group that we had in the Western Cape, coordinated by the organization. And so now they're giving support to all the shelters nationally. So they formed a national body, and even with the loss, they got lots of support from government. So they recognize structure, and that group has been working around the issues around women in the shelters. And those issues could be sometimes small issues, but also could be major issues. For example, the issue, what happens to women when they leave the shelter, where we're working with the Department of Housing in terms of allocating as a percentage of housing and using, having that group as a special group, which at the moment they're not. So there's a lot of issues and the lobbying group, that group is working around. But there was a national network that was set up from, because the Western Cape Network was the first network of this kind, because we're not a direct service provider. We coordinate service provision. We're bringing the service providers together to support each other, speak with one bigger voice, share resources, share information, and just work together in terms of the issue. So, and then a national network was set up later according to this model. But this network wasn't solely dependent, because the national network set up the other 8 provinces. So when it collapsed, I think 3 years ago, the other provinces suffered because they were solely dependent on them. So the only province that survived from the 8 was KZN Network. So we in partnership with them in terms of this new prevention program that we're starting now. And also the other thing I would mention in terms of how the national network collapsed, one of the big issues was that they were, though they were a network, they were still providing direct service provision in terms of counseling, which as a network you can't. So because you're competing with the member, which wasn't what's needed. So there wasn't even support when they were struggling. There wasn't even enough support from the members because of that. So, but this network has never been a direct service provider in any way. And the question of where we're getting our financial support, we're struggling. Last year we almost closed because of the issue from April until January this year. April last year to January this year. We got into a stage of I had to let go, and the director had to let go of staff, and I went alone from April to January as a network. But with this program, the new program we're starting, we were able to go back to, you know, full capacity. Now we've employed staff again, and we are able to use this is funds that are from USA, from USAA, USAID, in terms of this provincial program. And also then hopefully we would get also support locally. And also the Department of Community Safety and Social Development has really supported us even through the time. Without their support we would have closed down, because they said it's better to sort of like revive this structure now or hold it together than when you revive it something that's already dead. So that was at least support that we got from our government. And of course they only support the actual work, not salaries and things like that, which is another challenge that we're facing. Quickly, the issue of elderly abuse in terms of social development in their training, when they when we're doing the training that's provided by them, they always, because the issue of the elderly people is very much into their you know, program. So their violence against women program includes the part about abuse for the elderly. So we do provide that counseling, the training, and which part of it is counseling for elderly. And yeah, I think there was, okay, state and justice here. That was very much so committee, and making sure that they doing what they say, yes, the Justice Department committee, okay. Mm-hmm. And making sure that they're providing the support that they say they're providing. Because we need to make sure that, because there's so many committees that are put in place by departments, mm-hmm. and a lot of them are not ready in terms of practice. Mm-hmm. They're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Or, actually, our role is very much as well as support. Mm-hmm. So how do we then work with them to make sure that they're doing the work?
Thank you very much, Nunez. I wish you could extend your function that's looking at things like the issues of teenage pregnancy,
yeah.
You know, things like that. But also I wish, if we did as we wish as a committee, well, perhaps we could do it, try and invite the department, you know, to try and expose the type of work you are doing. It was my wish that you could work directly with the department, you know. But we will see how we... I mean, today we were not strategic enough. We should have made you present first.
That was the telephone. Sorry, that was from my desk. I found the report told me that I'll present before them. So apologies for that not happening because
I'm just in the... Oh, but also you
came
late.
Yeah.
So thanks very much. We'll see how we... You know, we make a better relationship. It is a new ministry, it is a new committee. I mean, it would not be wise to let go of resource people like you. Mm-hmm. It's not a wise thing. I know my members get carried away.
You know, I wonder if this could not be part of our site room. That the magistrates that preside over these murder cases should be women. Sorry? Oh.
Okay. Yeah. No, I'm saying, Chair, I'm not sure whether it could be part of our oversight role. That the magistrates that preside over these murder cases, we propose that it should be women, because you see the problem is that it's males who preside over these murder cases, and they have their own attitudes as well.
I wonder how that could be done, that we could get advice on how to do that.
Well, I'm passionate about this course. It's not only the magistrates, we need to talk to the prosecutors.
Mm-hmm.
They play a vital role, absolutely. And we need to get people who are sensitive to these issues. So this is why I'm so happy about the one-stop training that you're giving there, but I think we need more training for the prosecutors, for the magistrates, all those people. I think we hear now it's being done, but that's where we need to really make a start.
You okay? Thank you very much, Anelisa. And thanks very much for our visitors. We do hope this has been helpful to you, especially to the students. I'm sure you have picked up something. Thank you very much for coming.
I see all your bricks.